Time for Mac Break Weekly. We're getting ready for WWDC. Renee Ritchie, Andy Iannocco, and Serenity Caldwell are here to talk about Apple's new music endeavors, the new Apple TV, what might it include, iOS 9, OS 10, 10.11. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 457, recorded Tuesday, June 2nd, 2015. Mac Pro for sale. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple product is worth at gazelle.com. And by NatureBox. NatureBox ships tasty, guilt-free snacks right to your door with over 100 flavors to choose from, like mini Belgian waffles. You'll never get bored of snacking again. Try NatureBox at naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. And by lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/macbreak. That's lynda.com/macbreak. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest Apple news. And it's our yearly pre-WWDC issue. Andy Iannocco is here from the Chicago Sun-Times. Good to see you, Mr. I.
Good to see you too, Leo.
You will be, I just found out, joining us for our coverage of the keynote on Monday.
Indeed. I'm doing like three different keynotes in a row, all of which like from my Millennium Falcon flight deck of four different screens. This is too many in a 3 week period.
Yeah, we just had Google I/O. What else is coming up?
I even forgot the name of it. There's a big show in Asia that's going on where Asus just showed off a whole bunch of stuff.
Oh, Computex.
Thank you very much. And also all that stuff that we're going to be talking about the new Thunderbolt and stuff from Intel.
HomeKit. And holy cow.
It was really, really, it's a good week to be sitting in your own office.
Yeah, I feel like that, people often think, oh, you really want to be at the event. And you don't. You can't really do as much from the event as you can do if you're sitting in the cockpit.
Well, sometimes you do. I mean, especially at an Apple event where it's just as important to both get the temperature of the crowd in a live setting. And also there's if you have had experience, then there are things that you do outside of the actual keynote, whether you have formal briefings privately with Apple or you happen to see someone that you know and they're willing to have a conversation with you that you're not. Yes. That you can't quote anybody from.
That's so useful it's for valuable. You ink-stained wretches, but for us broadcast types.
So sometimes though you do have to if you don't have like a big travel budget, you have to ask yourself, okay, I'm going to spend $1,100 to be in San Francisco for 3.5 days. What am I going to get out of that? And sometimes it's like, yeah, I will lose some stuff, but I will have $1,100 in my pocket for which I can buy whatever they're going to announce there.
I feel like that's why we have the wonderful Renee Ritchie from iMore.com. He's going down there.
Yes, sir.
He's going down, Renee.
He's going down. He'll be and people are saying, what keynote? Monday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern time, 1700 UTC, WWDC. And we're going to talk about what kind of announcements Apple will have at its Worldwide Developers Conference.
Apparently it's the 2015th edition of the latest.
Yes. It's amazing. Since the year zero.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, maybe down with you, maybe in your briefcase, we're not sure, Serenity Caldwell from iMore. Hi, Serenity.
Hello.
It's harder. Well, I guess you guys are on the East Coast, so you got a long flight. It's a long way to go.
We do. For me, it's always worth it. I mean, I spent several years in San Francisco when I was first starting out, and I have a lot of friends there. So on that note, it's like it's nice to go and see everybody. But also, like Renee was saying, WWDC is so much more than the actual conference these days. That it's very easy to justify the 6-hour flight and the plane ticket at the expense of basically getting to spend an entire week with really awesome people.
But you like all the other press, get thrown out after the keynote, right? You can't stick around for the conference.
Yeah, usually that's true. In the past, I know Jason Snell has been able to spend the week and cover from a non-NDA perspective, the conference sort of to, but that's not necessarily the norm. I think that that might be a shift of Apple changing forward, where they are letting some journalists cover the keynote as a whole. But in generally also, have you been to the full conference in years past, Leo?
No, I was always kicked out, right? Yeah, I would love to. Are you kidding?
Yeah,
I paid my $99.
It's fascinating, and it's definitely worth the $1,600 to have face-to-face access with engineers. I went a couple years back for the full conference, and being able to interact with all those people one-on-one and talk to people who you may never get to talk to on an email chain to help troubleshoot and help work with your things. But also the sessions are extremely valuable. Now, most of them are now available online for free, which is really awesome. And that gives, that gives developers who have paid their $99 but aren't necessarily able to make a flight out to San Francisco most of the information that's covered at the conference. But there, I really feel like the face-to-face interaction and the fact that there are all these people from all over the world converging on San Francisco for a week, that's the special part of it.
Yeah, I mean, like the parties and stuff.
Oh,
hanging
yeah.
out at Starbucks. Yeah.
It's the weird thing. I feel like one of the best apps, actually one of the best apps that we use at iMore repeatedly is a little app called Napkin, just written by a couple of friend of friends of ours.
Right.
And I was sitting in a cafe that just makes sandwiches right across the street from Moscone when they came up with the idea.
Oh, wow.
And so it's really to be able to trace that and be like, that happened like 4 years ago years ago.
Did they write it on the back of a napkin, the idea? Because that would be...
I don't remember. I think it was a notebook, but it would be very poetic.
Poetic. Isn't part of the problem, though, that if you do stay for the rest of the... schedule, you are under heavy non-disclosure?
Again, yes, but less so than in recent years. It used to be that anything outside of the keynote was, off limits, that you couldn't mention it on Twitter. You couldn't blog about it if you were a reporter going who had bought a full conference ticket. Now it's a little bit more flexible. Now you can even, you can talk about the developer betas, but Apple's big thing still is they don't want screenshots and they don't want reviews. So they basically are saying, we're a little bit more okay of you talking about the stuff that we're prepping for the fall and the stuff that we're working on from the developer side. But we'd really appreciate if you don't say to the public, this is how it's looking in its final form. And this is what I think about. This is so awful because a lot can change between June and September. I've been on those betas circles for several years now, and the amount that changes and the stability differences are vast in those couple of months.
Yeah, and that's really true. Apple has really changed over the past, I'd say, 4 years regarding how tightly they lock down information from WWDC. Even stuff that you can get just as a member of the developer program. It used to be I was able to change my policy of not participating in the beta program because of the strict controls Apple puts on what you can do with the information that you glean from having early access to the next iOS or the new Mac OS. Now there's sort of a, so long as you follow a general no harm done rule, so long as you're not, like Serenity said, so long as you're not reviewing it, they're not willing to really get on your back about what you learned from the betas. And I think that the closest that we have to the old-fashioned Mac World Expos is WWDC, where it's not just the stuff that's on the schedule and the stuff that you get by actually attending the event. It's the fact that here is, for whatever reason, whether it's for WWDC or whatever, you have thousands of people who are in the Mac and iOS communities coming to the same city at the same time. So that is an excellent time that even if you don't have a ticket to WWDC, even if you don't attend the keynote, you will have opportunities to meet up with all kinds of people, sometimes two or three at a time during a lunch. And that's a time where, again, you can have there are questions that you can ask and information that you can get and deeper knowledge that you can glean from having just a good breakfast with a couple of people or a cup of tea on that roof garden at the Yerba Gardens than you can by spending 2 hours inside the actual event itself. So it can be very, very valuable.
Well, we'll do our best to bring it to you live. And Apple's already put up information about their live stream and updated the Apple TV too. So there's the Apple Events app, which you probably have. If you have that on your Apple TV, you'll be able to watch the stream there. But if you want our commentary, Mike Elgin, Andy Inako. We're not, myself and maybe some others, please tune in 10 a.m. on Monday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 1700 UTC for live coverage of WWDC. Actually, before we talk about WWDC, I think it's worth saying that there's some HomeKit stuff happened today. And in fact, Serenity has been already hard at work all morning testing some of this. So there's new hardware.
There is. After, you know, it's been just about a year since Apple announced HomeKit at last WWDC, actually. And throughout that year, manufacturers and third-party accessory makers have been busy at work getting their stuff certified and ready to actually launch. We saw some devices at CES, including some stuff from Insopio and a couple other manufacturers. But as of today, as of June 2nd, there are actual HomeKit devices in stores, on the market, and available for pre-order, with a lot more coming soon. Now, I think there are, Renee, correct me if I'm wrong, there are five to start off with.
Yep.
We collected, including the Ecobee 3 thermostat, a couple of, I forget what, the central hub. I think it's Intion central hub.
Instion.
There we go. I missed the T. Instion, as well as the Luan Cassetta, which is the one that I have been testing. That was the one that was available in the Apple Store today. So I drove over to the Apple Store in Providence.
No kidding. Wow. Yeah.
10 a.m. I walk in right after they open the doors. And I'm like, hey.
That's dedication.
So, yeah. I went up to their manager. I felt kind of bad. I was like, so here's the deal. You probably don't have this on your shelves yet. You probably don't even know it exists.
Oh, no. We have one in the back here. Let me get it for you.
Yeah. Our back of house. Yeah. He's like, let me go talk to my guy. And then he came out. He's like, I didn't even know we had these.
Well, it just came in. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is a company called, this probably well known to most people who do this kind of thing, Lutron. And
yes.
It's called Cassetta, and it's for wireless lighting specifically, right? It does do anything besides lighting?
Yeah, so it does wireless lighting and blinds, and it also hooks up with a couple of thermostats. At least in the app, it says that it works with both the Honeywell and the Nest. I'm going to try out the Nest later today. We'll see if the Nest works with Siri. Fingers crossed. That would be cool.
But this is what we always talk about in the Smart Things ad, which is, okay, so now you've got your lights and blinds and maybe your thermostat, but that's mm-hmm. another app on your phone, and then there's another app. So does HomeKit kind of eliminate that? Is Apple becoming the hub that talks to all these things?
Yeah, that's the general idea. So you still need the individual apps to set up those devices. They all have their own, of course, you know, there's various pairing, and you still have to hook up a hub to your Ethernet router. But once you've gotten it set up, and once you've set up the names of these apps and what rooms they belong to, then it hooks into this central HomeKit Siri system. So I actually just finished an article on how to use Siri with your HomeKit accessories. And basically, once you set up your HomeKit accessories, you can put them into rooms and zones that Siri recognizes. So for instance, my Lutron here that's loading, I have got a couple different setups for rooms and zones. I've got two rooms called the Space Shuttle and the Rec Room, respectively.
You have a space shuttle in your apartment?
I do.
So cool.
I do.
I can't have a hot plate in my apartment.
Or the benefits of Boston. Yeah. You can name them anything, which is really fun. Renee, of course, has been joking for years that he wants a Crash the Compound. And sadly, that doesn't quite work. Siri does require that you say turn on, turn off, dim, or set to a certain number or percentage. So it's not that cool, but you can still use custom names. So if I, you know, if I get on Siri here, I think this one is
you can say space turn shuttle. On the space shuttle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Turn on the space shuttle.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah.
That's nice. It did. It worked. I have seen so many of these
dim
demos.
Dim the space shuttle to 65. That might not work.
Okay. Yeah, it did.
I set the space shuttle light to 65.
Turn off the space shuttle.
Okay. Nice.
Turn off. And then you can, so that's the individual room, and the room can be multiple devices, including lights, including blinds, including thermostats. And you can set scenes. I haven't been able to make scenes work with Siri yet. I think it's just set up to use rooms and zones. But in theory, especially since HomeKit and the HomeKit devices support programmable scenes, I'm kind of hoping that in the future you'll be able to be like, set the lights to 65 when I leave my house, and it'll be able to combine geofencing with that. It doesn't do that yet, but I kind of wish it would. Yeah. One major bummer besides that as well is that if I go, you know.
She's talking to her watch now, folks.
Yeah, I am talking to my watch right now. If I pick up my watch and I go turn the space shuttle lights on, my watch says, I can help you control your home when you use handoff for iPhone.
Oh, so you have to hand it off.
Womp, womp, womp. Yeah. So I'm hoping that that's a temporary thing, because really, I want to be able to control my lights with my watch.
Right.
Come on.
Doesn't seem like...
There's an app.
Yeah.
There's an app for my HomeKit setup. Just not Siri integration. Just that. But overall, like this, the fact that I can pick up my phone and be like, set the lights to 65 is really cool.
I agree.
And I can't wait to try it out with the thermostat too. Cause I love the idea of like, if I'm bundled up and shivering on my couch, I'm like, it's too cold. Siri, set the thermostat to 72. Oh, laziness.
We should mention, this is not unique to Apple. This is Apple's first entry into this, but others have been able to do this. Mom's telling me that her Amazon
Alexa, the Echo.
The Alexa, yeah. Amazon Echo, can talk to smart things. So and actually that's even cooler because it's sitting right there and you can talk to it and it will do all that stuff.
There's one downside that you and I might run into, Leo, and that's you need new hardware for the hub. So we have Hue lights.
Yeah.
So we're probably going to have to replace that little white box because Apple's requiring end-to-end encryption for all the communications to protect passwords and things like that. And most of these devices weren't built with a secure Bluetooth or secure Wi-Fi chips to begin with. So the new versions, like there's an Ecobee 3, it's already on the market, but the one that's shipping in July is the same exact thing, but with those secure chips inside it. So if you want to use the functionality for HomeKit and Siri, you'll have to replace not everything, like not the lights and not speakers and not a lot of stuff, but the little hub or whatever they call the box that goes with it, the hub or the bridge or, you know, that component.
The little bitty hub.
Yeah. But at least it's hopefully just replacing the hub and not replacing every single Hue light or other small device. That you've already bought into. Like all of those switches will work as long as you have the new bridge.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of some NDA or some agreement seems to have lapsed at a certain time, because you can tell when there's one time of day where I'm getting like 18 different press releases every half hour about HomeKit stuff. And almost all of them, when I do follow-ups, they're talking about the exact same things, where you won't have to, if you're an existing customer, you can either just get an upgrade patch, you can do a firmware upgrade to whatever links it together, or we can sell you a very, very inexpensive new home link that will actually be better than what you have right now. Which is a great thing, because you're not going to get people to buy into a system if you're going to tell them that not only do you have to replace a lot of the light bulbs and a lot of the appliances in your house, but you have to make the VHS versus Beta versus Laserdisc versus Selectivision versus 9 other options, and that's the one you're going to have to base all your hardware on. One of the great things about all of these solutions cross platform is that buy whatever you want. You know, do a little bit of due diligence, but its chances are extremely likely that whatever you buy will work with whatever it is that you have.
Yeah. And it's good too, because I know a lot of people were hesitant to put any home automation things in their house because they saw that as attack vectors for their home network, that they were basically opening up things that could be used willy-nilly. And because this is end-to-end encrypted and they're insisting on it at the hardware level, as we move forward, I'm sure it's going to be easier for everyone to use those chips. Then hopefully every standard will use them, and we won't have anyone, you know, just for convenience sake, putting a lot of holes on their network.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing. Nobody, right now, there's few Internet of Things attacks. There have been a few, some FOSS cams, for instance, turned out the password protection wasn't effective. So people's in-house cameras have been put online, things like that. But I anticipate this is going to be a popular attack vector, if only to harass people. I mean, so what if you can turn my thermostat up, except it's annoying, right? It's not the end of the world. So I think Apple's very smart to insist on it, even though it's a pain point initially.
Well, yeah, and also I will say, go ahead.
I was going to say this. It's unknown at this time what the vectors are and what can be accomplished with them, because number one, there are a lot of these portals that try to get like sort of peer privileges with other network devices. And so in theory, if someone wanted to be super, super clever and choose the weakest point on your network, your thermostat as a point of entry, that's a problem. You may as well lock it down. The second thing is that, I mean, most of what we're looking at are things like thermostats, things like light bulbs, but you can do a lot of damage. If you suddenly if you know that the temperature at your target's house is going to be 18 degrees outside, if you take that thermostat and force it down to like 25 degrees or turn it off entirely, now you've got frozen pipes. Now you've got all kinds of nasty stuff happening. So I don't think, if anything else, it's a trust point for people. You're trying to get people to invite control of their homes to an entity that they don't absolutely understand. A light switch, you turn it on, you turn it off, you understand it. So to simply say that, look, we've protected this so that only devices that you approve and apps you approve can possibly control anything inside your house, that's going to be a necessary part of the marketing for this.
And not to be tinfoil hat dude, but a lot of these sensors that are coming online with HomeKit are exactly that. They're sensors and they keep track of how many people are in which room. And that's, you know, that might not be information that you want. And they move passwords around between the devices for authentication purposes. And that, like, one of the things that Serenity showed me that blew my mind is that you can add multiple Apple IDs to this stuff. So you can have more than one person with authenticated, you know, locked down encrypted control. And I wouldn't want those passwords moving around in less than secure devices either.
On top of everything else.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, I had my turn. Go ahead.
I was going to say, on top of everything else, that keeps you from having to enter in manual passwords. Like, nothing is more of a drag than launching an app and being like, all right, I have to enter in the 8-digit code to turn on my lights, and then it stops being fun. So instead, if you just have it all tied into Apple IDs, it just means, okay, you know, this phone and any phone using that Apple ID and any additional Apple IDs I authorize. So my boyfriend, you know, he can totally use my lights, but rando off the street, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. It's also, all I was going to say was that it's also important to sometimes, given the variety of manufacturers you have entering this space, there's extra peace of mind when you basically say that security is not something I need to trust the manufacturers to do, because it's built into a HomeKit. It's built into the system that I've put together. I mean, just last week, was it a really important Bitcoin app, I think for Android, was it, had a huge vulnerability. And part of the vulnerability was that the company based a lot of the security on an absolutely secure random number generator that it had to contact on another server. They had misconfigured the communication between the app and the server. And so what it was getting back was not a true mathematical random number, but an error code explaining why the number had failed. And so every single instance was using the same error code. And so it's like, and it's funny because I don't have any of my money in a Bitcoin wallet, but that's the sort of thing you're talking about, where maybe this is somebody who has a great business plan, and they've gone on Alibaba and they can buy like 1,000 of these light bulbs, and they're going to hire somebody and pay them not enough money to write the software for it, and they just screwed it up. So it's such a great selling point to be able to say that, look, you cannot call this a HomeKit product unless it has this level of security that you don't have to do yourself, because we don't trust you to do that.
And it might annoy early adopters like me and Renee to have to buy new hubs, but this is a brand new market, and so most people are starting out for the first time. So it makes good sense. In fact, it's ultimately going to be a differentiator for Apple if HomeKit is more secure and more.
We just installed the Ecobee 3 this weekend at Georgia's house because I don't have central air, so she installed it, and then we found out that we have to upgrade it. But it turns out it's just a modular component. I think it's $130 for the new one. So you pull it out and you put the new one in and you're good to go. And they were less concerned about the price than having to actually take the wiring out and rewire something again.
Yeah.
Because to them, the stress was the home doing the work, not buying it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I feel bad for SmartThings, but they are a sponsor. But I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I guess SmartThings is owned by Samsung, so it's not like they don't have the resources to see what Apple's doing and say, okay, I guess we'll do that too. And there's nothing wrong with end-to-end encryption.
And I think it works I think it's like CarPlay and Android Auto, where these devices can support multiple protocols, and that will be good for everybody, because you buy it and it doesn't care which one you have, as long as you have one of it, and one of them you can choose which one you want to use with it.
Well, and that raises an issue. So if you're working with Z-Wave and Zigbee, as SmartThings does, and they're not encrypted, how does Apple enforce its – it just says you guys have to rewrite your tool?
Well, it's hardware chips. So, again, like you have to use specific hardware chips for Bluetooth LE and Wi-Fi. Yeah, so to use those chips with – so hopefully that will force them all to become hardware encrypted. That's my utopian dream at least.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, well, let's finally get to WWDC. I imagine there'll be some HomeKit stuff to talk about there as well. Our show, Renee Ritchie's here, and Serenity Caldwell, both from iMore.com. Andy Iannocco from the Chicago Sun-Times. We're talking about Apple. I have some actual personal questions I want to ask you in a minute. Lisa's Apple Watch stopped pairing or would keep losing. And she says she did you call Apple? Is that what happened? She
told me to reset my settings on my phone.
Apple said reset the settings on the phone.
And so I reset my settings.
Yeah,
on the
and that
phone,
fixed it, and now it's
turned it back
now it's
on,
paired.
And it was instantly
okay.
Paired.
So
he said, if that doesn't work, wipe my phone.
Yeah, we did that. We don't
wipe my phone.
Wipe the phone and the
and
watch.
And I said, I don't want to wipe my phone right away.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
All right.
But it's paired.
She's got a 38, and apparently a number of people with 38s have had similar problems of the watch losing track of the phone. Mm.
Hmm.
Yeah,
so
that's weird.
Resetting the watch, resetting the phone.
Resetting the phone. We've reset the watch, obviously, but resetting
yeah.
the phone.
You know, I actually had that happen to my watch, I think, after I went on an airplane and I toggled airplane mode a couple times on and off. I actually wrote a how-to on it. For me, what you turn the watch on and off and you turn the phone
yeah,
on and off.
We did
so
that.
You reboot both of them. Yeah,
yeah. We did that.
Yeah.
We did that. Yeah. Which phone settings?
Just reset the phone settings so it wiped out all my Wi-Fi.
Oh, reset the phone settings. Oh,
yeah,
wiping them all
that
out.
Works.
That's a little more draconian than just rebooting. But
who cares?
So if rebooting doesn't work, try that.
Reestablishing Wi-Fi.
So yeah, you have several levels of reset, and what there was the least draconian level, which is just reset your settings.
Yes.
Cool.
Which is no big deal.
Good to know. If you're having trouble with your now, I have another question. Does anybody want to buy a slightly used Mac Pro?
Did you watch the Xeon announcements, Leo?
Here's my thing. This thing has been nothing but trouble, as you know. I had to trade it out. The initial problem I had was with RAM and USB. I'm having USB problems again. I'm getting that dread device drawing too much power, so we're, you know, dumbing it down. And I've reset the SMC several times. I've reset the PRAM several times. The only thing that that's plugged in at all now is a keyboard, and it's still saying that. So I know the keyboard's not drawing too much power on the USB port.
No.
So I'm just thinking it'd be a good time to buy a 5K iMac and maybe you'll have a nice-looking doorstop.
Especially with those new Thunderbolt ports.
So are the Xeons coming to the Mac Pro?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
You don't need Xeons.
I don't need Xeons.
A generation behind. Yeah, you'll be
no,
fine.
No, I think a 5K iMac. Can I I'm driving 27-inch cinema displays. I could still do that, right?
Yeah, sure. 4K displays are fine.
No big deal. Those are 2K displays.
Yeah, even better.
Yeah, nothing. Well, they're a little better than that. They're the cinema displays. It's 27.
Now, the 5K iMac is still running Haswell. They haven't done, as far as I can remember, done the Broadwell update for that yet. It may not matter to you because Broadwell's big selling point is power efficiency.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a
it's
desktop
plugged
computer.
In. Yeah.
So you might not care, but for people who want the latest and greatest.
I wonder how well, have they broken out Mac Pro sales numbers at all? I think that thing has not.
No,
has,
they don't break out any Mac.
That thing has cannot possibly be selling well.
Well, it's designed for a very niche market.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's not that is not a high like a normal consumer project. That is a custom machine.
The dunderhead market is really kind of small.
It's a Ferrari, Leo.
It's interesting when you look at there's so little difference between an iMac, a Mac Mini, and a Mac. That MacBook Pro right now, that it really becomes what shape will fit your lifestyle at this point. It's not about power and it's not about accessories. It really is about what shape will work for you.
Thank God I bought this base model. I didn't put in a bunch of stuff in there. I did. Oh, never mind. I don't want.
And if you get really upset, you know, I bet because it's a cylinder, I bet you could build like a potato cannon and just like shoot it,
fire
at
it
at a brick wall.
I say wear it to
get
formal
at least
occasions like a fest.
Views on YouTube.
It's a beautiful thing. But I also remember I bought the cube too. That was a beautiful thing too.
It's a collector's item, Leo.
Yeah, I wish
it's going to be like the cube.
Yeah, I wish I'd saved the cube. I would like it now, and I'm going to save the Mac Pro. I'm not going. We'll just put it on a shelf somewhere.
Set decoration. It works.
We and really after the Mac Pro came out, the new so-called Mac Pro came out, that's when we decided to go all Dell in our edit suites and Premiere, Adobe Premiere. That was the end of that. So at least I don't have 7 Mac Pros. It could be worse. Gazelle.com does buy your old iPhone, your iPad, many tablets, including Samsung, Microsoft, and Google tablets. It's a great way to get rid of old gadgets and get the new. There's always something new and exciting. And this is how you can kind of, you know, feed your habit. Bring it to Gazelle. Gazelle gives you top dollar. The price you get today is locked in for 30 days into July. So you have plenty of time to decide to see what's new, what's different. Buy the new device, transfer your data over, then send it to Gazelle. They'll pay the postage, turn it around fast if you forget or can't wipe your data, because they do buy broken devices sometimes, broken iPhones and iPads certainly. They'll wipe the data for you. Don't worry about that. They'll take care of you that way. They'll even upgrade the offer, as they have to us now twice, saying, oh, no, this is worth more than we thought. It's in better shape or whatever. It has more RAM, whatever, storage, whatever. So that's great. I never heard of a company, you know, I mean, they're only obligated to pay what they say they pay. They gave us a huge bump on a 4S, I think. I think they offered us $32, and they gave us like $100 instead. These are good people. Gazelle. After your item has been accepted and checked out, they will send you cash via check, PayPal, or an Amazon gift card. That's actually a good deal. They bump that by 5%. So if you buy a lot of stuff on Amazon, Gazelle's a great place. You can also buy on Gazelle. Did you know that? They keep the best stuff, and they resell it as certified pre-owned. Two conditions, certified like new. Nothing to say about that. It's as good as new. Or certified good, which shows the devices in both cases work perfectly. But the certified good devices might show some gentle signs of wear. But you're going to save even more money. In every case, they've been put through a rigorous 30-point inspection to make sure they're fully functional. And you have a 30-day risk-free return policy. It's Gazelle, the place to sell and buy now. G-A-Z-E-L-L-E, gazelle.com. I like this Elgato. You know, I've always had a soft spot for Elgato. Because they did the TV, the iTV. I really liked it. They have the Elgato Eve. I also like the name. It sounds like a feminine hygiene product, but in fact, it's a room weather door and window and energy sensor system. You can monitor outdoor or indoor air quality, temperature, and humidity. They actually have a volatile organic compound sensor.
Yep.
That's kind of cool. Mm. Weather is outside temperature and air pressure, door and window. So the idea is I could with impunity buy any of these, like the Ecobee that you just installed. Do you like that better than the Nest?
Yeah, some people didn't like the way that Google handled the transition and linking it to Dropcam IDs. And so there's some philosophical issues why some people switched.
Right.
I don't really care about the philosophy. For me, I like the fact that it has the remote sensors. So you put the Ecobee unit where your central thing is. But then depending on the size of your house and the way it's laid out, you put these little sensors in high traffic areas. Oh. And then it can adjust dynamically as you move through the house.
Oh, we
which
need
makes
that.
It more efficient. And I got a chance to interview the gentleman from Ecobee at CES, and he told me that he was, I think I might have said the story before, he was out traveling in Europe, and he started to see people, the number of people in his house increase, in his living room, you know, 10 people, 20
party.
People. So he called home, and he said, honey, are you having a party? No, Dad. And he goes, well, there's 25 people in the living room. He's like, ah, busted.
I love it. Yeah, so, I have that problem because we turn the thermostats in the hall will turn up the heat, but it gets really hot in the bedroom.
Yes,
because the hall is so that would be really so. I'd put an extra sensor in the bedroom, and then it would know. Oh yeah, we're overheating the bedroom now.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that we heard the most about the Nest, because Android Central, our sibling site, they did a whole week of Nest earlier on, and that was one of the things that we heard back is, I want to be able to get up and move and change rooms without having to constantly readjust
right.
it. And that's Ecobee's big selling point, because that sensor will recognize you, it'll do all that for you. And they claim it's even more efficient, because as you leave and maybe you forget to change things, it'll just know that you're no longer in that part of the house and shut things down.
Yeah, that would be really great.
Yeah. It's super easy install, too. I mean, like, we're borderline incompetent, and we got it up in on an hour or so.
That is borderline incompetent. No, I think I would guess you guys know what you're doing. I could
There's
be
no
wrong.
Evidence to suggest that, Leo.
More or less.
Sort of. All right. I'm sorry. I got distracted. I was just looking at these. So the Ecobee is $249, and then the sensors
You get one, and the sensors are 79 for two more. I would do that. That's
that
actually
supports up to like 30, which is a ridiculous number for most houses.
iHome, which has been around for a while doing stuff. They have a
smart plug. Like. The iHome I like because there's a lot of devices that aren't HomeKit compatible right now, but you can still just plug them into the wall. So I'm going to plug the Hue lights into that for now, and I won't be able to control them, but I'll at least be able to say turn on, turn off. And that will I won't have to go to the app all the time. I can use Siri for the base functionality. And if you have fans or any other product at all that's not HomeKit compliant, just plug it in here and use Siri to do the on-off function.
The plug becomes HomeKit compliant. That's a good idea. And so if you have a space station in your house, you can control it. Space shuttle.
That's new.
We should start taking bets
on
who
go ahead, Andy.
Who's going to get the honor of having the hardware that Apple demonstrates during the keynote next week? Who has shipping hardware that's going to be inside the Apple store that Apple chooses to say, guess what? You got 4 minutes. Don't screw it up.
Most of these are pre-order, but the Caseta, the Lutron is available, as you know, because Serenity got one. The Insteon Hub is pre-order. Pre-order also for the Elgato
Eve. I think the Insteon Hub might be today, but you can only order it. You can't buy it in the store.
Yeah. Starting in July. Yeah, a lot of these are ordered today, but not available. Or order soon, but not available yet. So my
big question is, did Apple put these out this week because it wants to clear the deck before WWDC and we won't see anything HomeKit related at WWDC because there's so much other stuff to do?
Well, there's an opportunity because Google, of course, is in this space too. We thought maybe Google would announce something at Google I.O., but they did not.
Well, Brillo, I guess, is the closest.
Yeah, but Brillo is not. Brillo is
it's early.
Long way off. Yeah. All right. So what are we going to see at WWDC? Andy?
Tim Cook.
Tim Cook.
Yeah.
hopefully. Untucked.
Tucked or
no. Oh, does Tim tuck? I think he's untucked.
I think he tucks his shirt. No, Tim doesn't tuck his shirts, but Jeff Williams, I don't know. Yeah. I don't keep track of this.
I can tell you one thing. They'll all be wearing an Apple Watch.
If Tim is untucked, there's no new hardware. Is that what it is?
Will there be new hardware?
Apple TV.
It would be really stupid, for instance, for me to buy an iMac now or any Apple product.
A lot of them have been refreshed. Like the MacBook Airs, the MacBook Pros have all been refreshed. I still haven't seen any signs of Intel having those Broadwell chipsets ready for the iMac. So I don't know. I mean, the sad thing is with Macs, they really are on Intel's roadmap.
Right.
So whenever those chips are ready.
But as you said, Broadwell isn't faster. It's just better energy usage.
Oh, so they might just bump it with Haswell and get slightly better clock speeds. But it's because Apple has a show, you should absolutely wait. But I don't think you'll see anything crazy with the iMac at this point.
Yeah. You said Apple TV.
Yeah.
Pretty sure we're going to see that.
The service might be delayed. Again, the Apple TV is under iTunes. It's not like the iPhone or the iPad. So it really is bound to the priorities of the iTunes organization. And it could be that they decide that the lack of content deals makes it not a compelling enough product to launch, which I think would be really sad because we've waited so long to get just the hardware upgrade. And I'd be super happy with that upgrade. But I think even if you don't get the Apple streaming TV service and you just get the modern processor, things like metal support, and you get the SDK, then that's a huge win for that device. And I think Apple, they don't need it at this point because it's not a major part of their business. But I think if everyone who does want an Apple TV, I think them getting back into that game in a serious way would be appreciated.
Apple TV, if they announce a new one, will feature an app store?
It should. I don't know if it'll be a game store or a full-on app store, but it should. I mean, there's every indication. As far as I know, they've had that for a long time and just have been sitting on it.
I can't put Twit on an Apple TV now. As it stands, only Apple can put anything on an Apple TV. I'd have to make a deal with
channel Tim partnerships.
Yeah, you can partner, but you can't. Right. You can't just build an app and submit it to Apple and hope that it appears.
But I would love that.
Whether they offer channels, we'll have to see, because it could just be if it's just a game system, then you'd have to make a Twit the video game. But if it is a full on SDK, then that'll open the doors for a lot more stuff.
We could have that happen. Like knock the head off Leo or something. I think
you have
one popular
episode of the Screensavers.
All right. And then you said they don't, we keep hearing they're going to work to create some sort of streaming TV service on there. Premature, obviously.
It's so hard.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to call. I suppose I can talk now that last year I had somebody high up in the TV industry who was an executive at a network who was telling me about some stuff. And it was the characterization of his remarks were not so much the details of this deal, but just how it's like Zeno's paradox, one of those things where the first step was to get half of the issue solved. The next step was to get another 25% of it solved. The next step was to get another 12% of it solved. And then you're left with a number of issues that both companies are very, very stuck on, and you need to have a shift in perspective before one of them decides to give ground. That was the nature of the conversation that I had with this guy, but that was a year ago. But that's not dissimilar to the conversations I've been had over the past 2.5 years about bringing more content to Apple TV. People that it's like Manhattan real estate. I mean, you own this property. And you are not going to let, and you know, there's a limited number of it. If people want property on this block, if people want CBS, you're not going to be able to go anyplace else to get CBS. So you're going to hold out to get exactly what you want. And if you have another, if Apple or any other aggregator wants to get access to that content, and they have these ideas about what they want their service to be and the sort of things like privacy and not using this channel as a way of the advertisers being able to learn things about the viewing habits of its viewers. If you don't get that, you're not going to get that. There's so many different things that could scotch us at this point that I've given up on predicting or assuming that any deal is going to be announced at any time.
Recode, Don Chmielewski and Peter Kafka writing in Recode say Apple's subscription TV service won't be announced next week. Although they do quote Les Moonves, who was at the Code conference last week, saying that he thought CBS, he's the head of CBS, he thought CBS would probably sign a deal with Apple to carry his network. We're very excited about it, he told Kara Swisher. So far, the main negotiating point, according to Moonves, money. Yeah. How much you going to give me?
Surprise, surprise.
But there's also, I think, some fear that if you go over the top with a network, that you could alienate the cable networks, the cable companies, which are the MSOs, which are very important to television networks. You've got to be careful there. So it may be, in fact, that it'll be like every other system except HBO now, where you have to log in with your cable company subscription to demonstrate that you should be getting CBS anyway.
Yeah.
Apple apparently wants to do live TV. That's another thing.
They're super patient, too. I mean, they've waited years. The Apple TV hasn't been updated since March of 2012, and they could have updated it every year the way they did the iPhone and iPad. And they just waited because they believe that this is the problem that they want to solve. And Steve Jobs said it very well at the All Things D conference many years ago, that if you think dealing with carriers is hard, dealing with all the tiny little fiefdoms that are cable networks, not just in the U.S., but internationally, is an absolute nightmare. So the technology has never been an issue for them. It's the go-to-market strategy involving content that's always been the big hang-up.
Yeah. Well, because it's really very thorny, because networks don't necessarily own all the content that they broadcast. Mm-hmm. So maybe the deal that they have with a production unit or with another studio says that, no, you don't get to simply package us with streaming content, because we have our own package that we want to sell elsewhere. Or you're going to have to open up brand new negotiations with us. This is why on a lot of if you go to websites for networks, some shows you can get on-demand streaming, some you can only get clip packages, and that will identify to you the sort of deal that production company has with that network. So it's really difficult, and it is too bad. I mean, yeah, I hope that Apple, even if they don't get this service ready for the next 2 months, Apple TV is just looking so moribund. It's not just the idea that it has not gotten a significant upgrade in a couple of years. It's an unpleasant experience to use Apple TV compared with all these other alternatives that are out there. I mean, Fire TV is at least as good as Apple TV, minus the AirPlay. Google Television is also it's a product that Google seems to be interested in growing, and they're not interested in waiting for every piece to be to be complete. So even if all they did was that, we're going to revamp the interface, we're going to make authentication a lot smoother, we're going to make sure that you almost never are confronted with a black screen and a spinning dial that says authenticating buffering. That's a win for me. And so I just hope that Apple, sometimes you really do have to indicate that this is an important product, and Apple has not indicated that with Apple TV in quite some time.
And to Andy's point, I mean, one of the problems with Netflix has been they haven't been able to get shows because of things like music rights, and they'd eventually have to take a long time and strip out all the music or even change.
So sad.
I think Dawson's Creek has a different theme song on Netflix than it did originally.
The famous example of that is the radio show. WKRP in Cincinnati, where they had real music in it, and that's why you don't see it in reruns, because it's all real music and it's not licensed for replay.
So Yeah, yep. There's such so many laws.
Well, it's sad. There's documentaries like The Eyes on the Prize, the documentary of the Civil Rights Movement, can't be shown because the estate of Martin Luther King won't give them the rights to continue to show that I Have a Dream speech and other things. Will the new Apple TV be a HomeKit hub? That would be why you might announce that.
It ought to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't see why it shouldn't be. The real question is whether or not you'll need to connect it directly to your Ethernet cable.
We don't want that.
End-to-end. Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, you know, for us, our router lives in the basement.
Right.
So trying to run an Apple TV, you know, a long cable up to your Apple TV might be a little bit of a hassle there. But I don't know if the end-to-end encryption can be done over AirPlay or over just straight wireless when you're making that initial connection. Renee, you might know better than I.
Yeah, it's been years, and as far as I know, they've experimented with different things. And for example, at one point, they were thinking about putting the entire router into the Apple TV for people who just wanted an all-in-one solution. And as far as I know, one of the bigger rumors was that it was just going to be a way for you to control HomeKit when you weren't at home. So as long as they could have an Apple TV there, they would be able to track, you know, it's sort of like that we do with Back to My Mac, where they take I forget the actual way that it works, but they keep track of your IP address and they substitute that for your Apple ID and then always put those two things together. So even if you're at the airport and think you forgot to turn off the lights, you can still connect via your device and you have a secure connection to your Apple TV, which is a trusted device on their network, and you can handle things. I don't think they're going to let it do much beyond that. Like, they won't let it be a substitute hub, but just that functionality, they should be able, with those chips that do the encrypted Bluetooth LE and encrypted Wi-Fi, they should be able to have it as a happy network citizen, regardless of Ethernet.
Yeah, there's so much potential in Apple TV. When you think about it as having a small, tiny, hideable device that runs off of a mobile processor that generates very little heat and draws almost no power, has Wi-Fi and Bluetooth each built into it, can also be and is and in a fixed location in a house. You're describing a computer that is, here is the one device that we can count on always being turned on and available to the internet for any sort of device that's outside of that network that wants to communicate with lights, with heating, with printers, with any sort of device that's inside that house. And also the ability to simply identify that, okay, well, the closest iBeacon to the user right now is the Apple TV that we know is in the living room.
Yeah.
So we know that we know that where this signed in user is going to be. So none of this is based on conversations I've had with people, but it's just such an obvious thing that even if they did nothing cosmetically to the user interface or the user experience, just the ability of having this always on device, always connected to the internet, and the most wireless device they have tethered to a specific location, it's a long 8-page list of things you can do with that sort of capability.
Just taking a step back, it's really interesting to see we've come so far. The way technology gets better incrementally, you kind of sometimes don't notice it, but we're now talking about really finesses of capabilities and amazing things like being in proximity to your Apple TV and then the iBeacon sees you. And these are really kind of amazing technologies that they've crept up on us.
It's the future, somehow.
Tomorrowland.
The big win always of investing in Apple is that they make things that just take advantage of each other's presence. The fact that you have an iPad in the same room as your phone and your iPad can simply glom on to your phone's internet connection, not by walking over your phone and turning on a Wi-Fi hotspot, but by simply like it's an active Wi-Fi hotspot waiting to be turned on by this device. That's why you have a phone and a tablet and a notebook that's all created by the same company. So you extend that to the home and you think, ooh, nobody knows how to make everything work together as one, as aggressively and as safely and as reliably as Apple.
Yeah, at the same time, if I was playing with, I don't want to name it, possible sponsor, new kind of Netflix-style service, playing with the Apple app, and I noticed it had Chromecast capability. It didn't have AirPlay. Mm-hmm. It had Chromecast. And I wonder if that's – are you starting to see that trend where there's – I mean, they've sold, what do they say? They sold 17 million Chromecast. What's the number? It was a large number of Chromecasts.
It's
1.7 million.
Yeah, that's, which is still peanuts compared to Apple TV, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
But they're having a really big success with it, considering that this is a $30 device. And they're making it really, really easy for any developer to say, oh, sure, what the hell, we'll include Chromecast support. And now it's hard for me. I would have to do an audit of all the stuff that I have on my phone, my iPhone and my iPad. just to say nothing of the stuff I have on my Android phone. But it's hard to mention, it's hard to think of an app that makes sense to have Chromecast support at this point that does not have Chromecast support.
Yeah.
It is really, really cool to have a Slingbox connected to your cable box, and just simply the fact that I have this little $30 thing plugged into my living room TV means that I don't have to do a cable run through two floors in order to get there, because the Sling Player app on my iPad is going to be able to make that connection for me.
It was one of the things that I think gets overlooked a lot, is that when you have an iOS device, you have a pretty amazing Google experience. Like, Google makes almost all their apps. I think Keep is one of the big exceptions, but you know, that's pretty much a web view now anyway. And Chromecast and all of this is well supported. Nest, all of those kinds of technologies. You have, I think Paul Thoreau said it really well when he said you have amongst the best Microsoft support on it. Amazon, you go down the line, and if you really want to have, you know, Google ecosystem, it's not as good as having Android, but it lets you have the Apple parts that you want, and the Google parts you want, and the Amazon parts you want. And that's an advantage to a lot of consumers.
So Chromecast, 17 million. Do we know what Apple TV sales were? They had 10 million units sold in 2013.
I don't think they said recently.
They haven't said lately. Yeah. But given the number sold per year in the last 6 years, there are far more than 17 million out there.
Yeah. Chromecast should be accelerating much faster, though, because of the size of the Android market, and the low cost of it, and how small and portable it is.
Yeah, it's tough, though. It's no matter how good certain Android or Google products are, it's so hard to remind people that these are available to them. Remember that Google Wallet existed for about a year, year and a half before Apple Pay. And even I had to be reminded that, you have a Nexus 5, you have the ability to do contactless payments, Andy. This is just an app that you just noticed, you wrote about, then you forgot about. If you actually spend 5 seconds to activate it, you too can have fun with your phone paying for things at McDonald's and Panera Bread.
Well, it was frustrating at first because the carriers were blocking it. So if you had a Verizon phone, you couldn't use it because Verizon had their own ISIS system, now called SoftCard. But that's all kind of gone by the wayside, so... Wallet has come into its own. And now Wallet's not going to be Wallet anymore. It's not going to be Touch to Pay. It's going to be peer-to-peer
Android
payments.
Pay.
Yeah.
Android
Pay is the new thing. Yeah.
I think that folds in the technology that they bought that was being used by a lot of carriers anyway, which is nice.
Yeah, they bought it. So I think they bought SoftCard, right?
Yeah, SoftCard. That's it.
Yeah. All right, we're going to talk about the music subscription service, because that's really going to be, I would bet that's going to be the biggest story. Maybe, well, I don't know. What's the biggest story going to be on Monday at WWC? It's going to be the music, right? Because you're going to want to be there, because there's going to be the Foo Fighters will be there or somebody.
Because
right?
Drake will be DJing.
Yeah. You know what? I actually think the biggest thing we'll see are new versions of iOS and OS X. Those are going to be the flagships without
question.
That's because
you're geeks. No.
Nobody
gets excited about that. Come on.
We're talking about a developer conference. Okay. We're talking about the things that developers are going to be excited about. As a consumer, sure, I can be like, ooh, a new music service. But the things that are going to actually fundamentally change how we use our devices, the security improvements that are going forward in OS X, is that something that's going to be like, ooh, so shiny? No, not so much. But I think those are going to be like the big important things.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in terms, like, if we want to talk just straight consumer shiny, it's probably going to be a divide between the new music service and the Apple TV. I still don't think that they're not going to put on a show the way that I think they do with, say, the iPhone or the Apple Watch events. They're going to be more thinking about positioning it as a developer device, as well as like, this is really cool, but I don't think we will get Drake DJing on stage. I kind of feel like that's maybe at the bash on Thursday, maybe we'll have Jimmy Iovine and all his buddies at the WWDC bash being like,
no,
let's celebrate our new music service.
You don't think Dre and Iovine will be on stage on Monday?
Oh, they might. No, they might. I'm just saying we won't have I don't think we'll have a musical performance. Yeah.
Oh, I bet we will. Well, you know what? Let's take a break and we'll debate it. How about that? Music next, the new Apple streaming music service. But first, snacks, because I know you spent all morning, Serenity, doing the HomeKit thing, and you're eating some cold fridge lunch. That's not good. We need to feed
you. Not as good as snacks.
We got to give you some nice. Everybody loves snacks, but wouldn't it be nice if snacks were as healthy as your meal? Nature Box makes healthy snacks you will love, like mini Belgian waffles. What?
Oh, my God.
What? You know, you got a snack, so why don't you eat something tasty, satisfying that doesn't make you feel terrible afterwards? Over 100 healthy, crave-worthy options, all nutritionist-approved. Never any artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. 0 grams of trans fat. No high-fructose corn syrup. Just delicious stuff like this. Honeycomb sunflower kernels. We know sunflower seeds are full of great stuff for you. Give them a little boost with some honeycomb flavor. And they're, you know, it's simple. If you look at the ingredient list, it's always short and sweet. It's just what you expect. Oh, I hear somebody snacking already. These are Andy's eating. What are you eating there?
The probiotic fruit and nut mix.
Those are good. That's good. Blueberry Greek yogurt pretzels. These are really good. Sarah Lane stole all of them. We had to get a whole new shipment in. White truffle popcorn, coffee kettle popcorn. These are just 5 snacks. There are many more awaiting you at naturebox.com, like strawberry lemonade, fruit stars, or sweet and salty nut medley. Now, here's what I want you to do. Get the free sampler first so you know what you're getting into. A trial of your favorite snacks delivered right to your door. Just pay $2 for shipping at naturebox.com/twit. And we thank them so much for their support of MacBreak Weekly, not just of the show, but also they feed our staff. We get, I don't know, we have like 8 Nature Boxes a month or something coming. We have a huge number. Very tempted. All right, music. We know a lot, I think. It is all just rumor. Apple's not said anything. This dates back to the acquisition for $3+ billion of the Beats service, the Beats company. They got the headphones. They've already started selling those. They've even updated them. They've got new wireless headphones and so forth. So they're still in the headphone business. But most people agree the real gem in the crown of Beats was their streaming music service. Not because it had so many subscribers, just 100,000 or so. But because Apple needed, after many years of turning its back on streaming music, to do something. What will they do on Monday? Serenity, you got thoughts on that?
I go back and forth on how detailed the service will be on Monday. Obviously, they've spent a long time getting deals together. Beats has their own group of artists that they've worked with. iTunes Radio has their group. I think what we'll see primarily is we'll hear a lot about the new music app, which is in beta right now for iOS developers. We will probably hear about the new unified service, what it's going to look like, what its name is going to be. Is iTunes Radio going the way of the dodo? Is Beats Music dead to the water? I kind of feel like the Beats Music brand might stick around for headphones, but I don't know if it will continue to be the overwhelming name for the subscription service. And then we'll find out what pricing looks like, whether we're going to look at more like the Beats Music service pricing, whether they're going to lower the Beats the service pricing to an even lower buy-in, whether or not they're going to have a free tier that's been talked about a lot. In general, it really comes down to look, pricing, and name. And they'll probably have some big headlining thing music-wise. And we've got, Beyonce exclusive to our platform or something like that to really sell it to the music nerds.
I'd be surprised since Jay-Z owns a competing service, but it could happen.
It's business, Leo.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry. I mean, I couldn't resist the blueberry Greek yogurt pretzels. You caught me.
So good.
It's complicated. I mean, there's everybody in business who talks about this talks about how you can see that more people are, if they got X dollars to spend per year on music, they're spending more of it on subscription services and less of it on actually purchasing music. So it's certainly in Apple's best interest to simply decide that they need to switch. That they need to switch from an iPod idea to an iPhone idea before they can no longer sell iPods, so to speak. So they want to get this done sooner rather than later. But the question is, people have a lot of habits, and so it's going to be a fight between people whose habit is to use a service like Spotify versus buy music. And then so once you get someone to make that switch, are you going to switch anybody who is using Spotify? They're not brand new here. They've not just started using streaming music services. So they probably have Spotify. They have all their playlists set up there. How easy is it? How attractive is it going to be to switch to an Apple service? And how easy is Apple going to make it to switch from Spotify to this new service? So there are just so many variables here that I can't even predict success or failure. All I got to do is hope that they do at least something to improve the music app, which is one of the real weak points of iOS.
You mean iTunes? Yeah.
No, the music app on iOS and iTunes as well. I mean, yeah. This is there are a few apps that I really believe really need to be destroyed and then replaced with something brand new. And I think that music is it. It's just it is such a lash up of all the years it's been available and all the years all the changes in how people acquire and consume music that I don't think it serves anybody particularly well. It's frustrating as hell for me to just figure out what is on my device right now, what is not on my device right now. If I want to listen to this to this album right now, what is going to cost me in terms of Wi-Fi or broadband connectivity versus what is already on my phone? And the fact that it's that hard to get even that done, so the fact that it's so hard to do even searches, just tells me that I hope that if they start a brand new streaming service, I hope it works well for them. But I just want a music player that works better than the one I have right now.
Well, iOS 8.4 has the all new music app already. Like it's in beta. I'm not enough of a music aficionado. I barely ever open that app. It's my secret shame. I don't listen to a lot of music on my phone, but it is all new and all different. I guess people have opinions on that.
Even if you are an aficionado, the chances are the aficionados are opening Spotify or something else, RDO.
Well, I think that's
the real risk for Apple, is they're going to lose the business entirely.
I think that's absolutely true. But there's a lot we don't know about what they're doing, but we can see what they have done. And that is, they were going to launch iTunes Radio, and it went out in the US and it went out in Australia, and then it stopped. And they bought Beats, and people were still wondering what was happening with iTunes Radio. Well, after they bought Beats, all of that went away, and they started making a bunch of new plans. And there were some ups and downs with the development of what those new plans were going to be. But the key things for Apple was the human curation that they thought that Beats did really well. They thought that was an advantage, that they had sort of these people behind it. And a lot of people did like the results of whether it was absolute human curation or some blend of it. They did like the results, and rolling that across the entire catalog when they start hiring. And there's rumors, I think, just earlier this week about Drake and Farrell and Dre and how the service might be a lot more. Like, it might actually have a DJ factor to it. That's sort of how they want to compete. I guess they feel like they were at iTunes. A lot of the world is now in Spotify or something else, and they want to offer what they think will be an interesting service for where people go to next.
That's what Jimmy Iovine said from day one with Beats, before it was an Apple product, was we're going to bring back curation. We're going to bring back real people telling you what to listen to. And it's, okay, but it didn't exactly make Beats a world beater. I think it might be a little too late.
Well, it was U.S. only. It was mostly, I think, it tied to AT&T at the beginning and getting scale at those kind of services. I remember the early days of Spotify. I think it started, I might be remembering wrong, but I think it was one of the ones that started in Europe, and people were waiting for it to move. And
Scandinavia Apple's first, then Europe, yeah.
Yeah, Apple's ability, the thing that Apple can do for Beats, because Beats can do curation for Apple, and it brings Jimmy Iovine in, and that helps relieve Eddie Q's monstrous job, which is already huge enough, but it is to help them scale. Like, they can get the Beats headphones into all the stores, but they can also get whatever this new service is called into that music app on hundreds of millions of iOS devices. And that Apple's advantage is when they hit that update button, it took a little while to get to 80%, but it took almost no time at all to get to 60, 70%. Adoption for iOS 8 and iOS 9. At the very least, people will see it and maybe press it, and that's an advantage that they're going to have over a lot of their competitors.
There's curation and other things too. In fact, Andy, I remember, boy, that was a great thing you did. And I recently re-upped for Spotify. I had let it lapse because I was using Google Music, but when Spotify started carrying our podcasts, I re-upped, and all my playlists were still there, including that great one you did where you invited. And this is where Spotify really shines. You invited people to add to a public Spotify playlist the one song. The song, if you had only one song to pick, that you would pick as the song. And I love that playlist. It's still there. Yeah. It still works. It's great. That's curation. In my mind, that's the best.
Yeah, there's so many variables here. Curation is a really great thing, but honest to God, I don't care about the credentials of the person that they picked to curate a certain playlist. Random person on the internet that simply has good taste, picks songs that I like and is a lot more adventurous than I am. Don't care if they never work for the BBC. Don't care if they're making $18,000 a year. They're the person that I'm picking to curate, and anybody can do that. So I just don't know what they there are times when you say you just don't know, and you mean that sort of as a backhanded, well, this is a stupid idea. I'm saying I literally don't know what Apple would have to put into a streaming service to make it into a successful thing. Although, as Renee says, just the simple fact of an app that comes preloaded on every single phone that ships is a huge, huge advantage for whatever service that Apple chooses to ship.
I see. Yeah, I know that we don't care.
Go ahead, Renee. Okay.
Sorry, I was going to say quickly that.
Renee!
I just going to say quickly that it doesn't really, like, I'm the same as Andy. Like, I wouldn't know who was curating it, but I don't see the appeal of Beats headphones and the loud bass. And obviously those are hugely popular. So maybe the millennials or whatever the proper term is for the Generation X really do care that it's Drake or Pharrell or Dr. Dre. And that, along with it being on their phone, is going to make it an attractive service to them. Because, you know, you never know what's going to be the next big hit thing. You can only hope that you have enough ingredients. And it seems like at least that's the way that they're going with it.
Superstars.
Go ahead.
It's all about the superstars. Oh, I honestly, I was just going to make a joke about, you know, not front loading it with you too. But no, seriously.
That would be nice. Yeah. No, I like it.
I love you too. I was.
I think the playlists I like and I'm interested in, you know, when Rolling Stone says the 500 greatest rock and roll songs of all time, that's a list I would load. And KCRW has a summer playlist that's updated regularly. And that's in Spotify, by the way. That's a list I would load. So there are some lists I load. Because it's often the case that you kind of want to listen to music without picking it, but you don't want necessarily a Pandora-style radio station. So playlists work quite well there. And so I thought it was very interesting the way Beats did the curation. You build a sentence. I think it'll be interesting to have superstar people. As you say, Renee, everybody's going to have it, and they're going to have it presumably free for a month, although Apple would be smart to make it free for the first 3 months or something like that.
Yeah, give them some time, and also integrating it both with Siri, with the phone, with CarPlay will be huge. I know one of my frustrations right now with Beats and with Audio and a couple of the other streaming services that I try is that when I'm commuting, when I'm driving up and down New England, it's very hard for me. Like if I want to switch a playlist in the middle of driving and I'm on Beats, I have to pull over to the side of the road and pick up my phone and like select things because there's no way to say, hey, switch to this Beats playlist or switch my sentence.
That's because you're using an iPhone. I hate to tell you. On Android.
Put it on your watch, you'll get arrested.
Yeah. On Android, you can just say to your phone, I want to listen to the Rolling Stones and it'll play it.
Sure. I could do that on iTunes Radio. I just really don't like iTunes Radio right now.
You get to choose on Android what is the default music system, so you could make it be Spotify or whatever.
But that is an insight into what could be really awesome if it hooked it into Siri in a very natural way with a lot of deep learning.
I agree.
The ability to say, I want to hear a lot of rock from the past 3 or 4 years that is different from anything that I've been listening to for the past 5 months. Which is a really complex thing, but it shows you the sort of thing I'm talking about. I mean, that's the sort of thing that natural language can do and that a subscription service can do that my own collection can't. I do have, I think like most people, I have some curated playlists that I have a lot of fun managing and moving songs in and out of. But really, that doesn't help me to discover new music, and it doesn't help to surprise me with stuff. And it's not always tailored to every single thing. So if that could be integrated with Siri, not only would it be a great feature, but it would also be a way that Apple could sort of hit a feature over the heads of every other streaming service, because nobody is going to have this level of integration with Siri as Apple will.
That's true.
And to Andy's point, what I would really like is we saw a lot of continuity last year, but we didn't see any for media. And I would just love to walk away from my Mac and the playlist to just automatically go to my iPhone or my Apple Watch, or walk away from my Apple TV and the movie just to seamlessly switch to my iPad. There's so many interesting things you can do once you're broadcasting activity, once you can move that activity. And it's going to be complicated. I noticed there's handoff on the watch now. Serenity was showing it before. And I'm typing a message on my watch and I decide I'm a little frustrated because I want to say something else. I can just pick up my iPhone and swipe up. But then I have Safari on my Mac, and it's not quite sure whether I want to hand off Safari or hand off Messages. But I think that whole area, once it gets really good at that, and I can move video and audio and all those kinds of things as well, then that convenience of having that whole ecosystem again becomes powerful.
Yeah. But that brings up another point, and if I'm changing the subject, we can come back to it.
Change
later.
Away. I have no.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying that a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, a lot of stuff we've been reading with other people about, is that it's not so much going to be here's this brand new shiny thing that we're releasing in iOS 9, but we are basically trying to make all the features that we've been rolling in there for the past year or so work better. And Renee, I mean, you bring up something that was just so frustrating this morning, where I was having breakfast with a friend of mine, and I ran into construction, so I had a detour around it, so I was very late. I knew my friend was at the restaurant with his iPhone next to him, and so when we were at a red light, I just raised up my Apple Watch and said, text so message so and so, I'm running a little bit late. If you order this for me, I'll probably be there in 12 minutes. And then he never got it. And the reason why was because he was because he was logged into Messages in his house, but not logged into Messages on his phone. And whereas I assumed that because I was sending him a text message from my watch connected to my phone, it would send it as an SMS. It said, no, I'm just going to send this to his computer in his office, on his phone. And that's the sort of thing that makes you makes you wonder. I hope Apple doesn't make a car, because that would be a very surprising first month of driving if that sort of logic
winter tires
is,
are on this
isn't
car.
Here. Yes. It's like, I found a better route for you. It involves cutting through this backyard. You're welcome. So if all Apple does is really make the point that here is how we're trying to make your overall experience better, that would be the best win for me. I don't care about this new gee whizzy features that they want to put in. I just want fewer moments like that. And incidentally, the way to fix that was to go into my phone settings and basically say that, look, forget iMessage for text messages. Always send them as SMS, which would solve the problem for me. And there's other things I could do. I had to change a bunch of settings to make sure that wouldn't happen again. But the fact that that would get through and be a problem is just surprising to me.
Yeah. People are asking for a link to your Spotify one song playlist. We could start over again, right? We could actually, people could start adding to it again. There's 170 some songs on there already.
I could tweet that out tomorrow.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, Tonya Angst actually introduced that to me because
a small world. That's nice.
Because she was having a birthday party for Adam, and decided as a gift she decided to ask all of his friends to recommend one song and one song only to add to a playlist. And after I realized that, wow, that's a fun challenge, because if I'm only going to recommend one song, it doesn't even necessarily have to be the best song, but here is one song you really like that you want someone else to know about. No blog post behind it. No, mm-hmm. You have to listen to the album first. I'm saying you just get to tell me a title and nothing else. It's an interesting challenge, and you wind up with a really interesting playlist.
Did you have to manually add the songs, or could people go to Spotify and add that?
No, I was matter of fact, I did it on Twitter, and every time I saw a song that was and people were doing it with replies, and then someone actually created that Spotify playlist for me before I got around to doing
Fido
it.
Fido did. Okay.
I was gonna sort of curate it a little bit more, but as soon as like it was halfway done and this playlist appeared, I realized that, wow, this is much, much better than having someone offer an opinion on these picks. So let's just, you know, have it come on.
It's kind of crazy because it's all over, you know, it's Bruce Springsteen to Johnny Depp.
But that's exactly what you want. It's you want that random seed. Mm-hmm. It's inside your playlist. It's like you want to make sure this is not based on any sense of logic. It's not trying to profile you or guess what you want. Right. It's just simply saying at some point you just have to throw the dart at the world atlas and learn about something that you had never even considered looking at before.
As you can see, I've subscribed, and this was way back when I was a Spotify user. I subscribe to a lot of playlists. There's Biblify.com had a variety of playlists. KCRW, I mentioned. So there are people who, I guess, I presume to this day continue to publish curated playlists. So in a way, this kind of curation exists. It's not as, you know, cool as Making a Sentence or Jimmy Iovine's Top 5, but I think this is one of the reasons Spotify has done so well. And it is sticky. Especially once you start adding these playlists to your collection, you can't get that into another service.
Yeah, it's and again, it's hard to imagine what kind of value gets what kind of value that any service could act by saying, "Look at this incredibly talented playlist curator that we hired." It's right. not going to be the credentials. It's going to be look, show me one of your playlists. Wow, that's awesome! Great, okay,
right.
I'm in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who Kieran Donahue is, but he created a list called the 500 Greatest Songs of All Time, and you know what? It's a good list. I mean, okay, it may not be your list, but that
means that at least 130 of them are going to be songs you've heard so
a million
often
times.
That you're kind of, yeah.
I like your one song list. It's my favorite playlist. Cedric Ingron did a Guitar Heroes playlist. You know, what's interesting is when he first created this playlist, more than half of the 41 songs were not available from Spotify. As of today, almost all of them are. Yeah. So I find that kind of interesting, right? The playlists have really expanded what you can get.
No, I love that. And you know what? There is Beats has a playlist section where it's not just, you know, make the random sentence, but there are folks working behind the scenes building these really, really great playlists. There's one woman in particular, Susie Cole, does amazing classic rock playlists that I got completely addicted to the point where I was just downloading anytime she would do a new playlist, I'm like, oh yeah, I'll listen to it, even if it's not classic rock, because I know that your taste in music is good.
And it's the new form of DJ, right?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Well, nothing wrong with competition. I hope Apple knocks it out of the park. I'd love to see a great service. We know they're going to charge $10, right? It's going to be the same as everybody else. The music industry would have to give them a break to change that, right?
I don't know. I mean, we've heard rumors for $7.99.
Yeah.
But that may just be Apple taking a cut to try and boost adoption.
Right. The other thing Apple could do, as Amazon and Google have done, is integrate your existing collection, your iTunes collection, into any streaming service. I'm sure they will do that. And that's an advantage Apple does have over Spotify.
They have iTunes Match already, just sitting and waiting.
Yeah. So that would be pretty cool. What will we hear about OS X and iOS? You said that was the most exciting thing, Serenity. What are you excited about?
I think it's the most exciting, in part because I like new software. I like being able to do new things with my already very powerful iOS and Mac devices. On the Mac side, the big rumored improvement is this new security system called Rootless, which I'll let Renee talk a little bit more about since he's more up to date on it than I am. On the iOS side, we're looking to see a bunch of sort of improvements across the board, but one of the biggest rumored ones, at least according to Mark, I have all of the sources, Gurman from 9to5, is a new version of Siri integrated with Spotlight and a couple other services, codenamed currently Proactive. Now, I don't know if this will actually appear in the next version of iOS in its final form, but anything that allows Siri to do more things, I am on board with. That makes me happy. That makes me excited. And we've also heard that that we might see some more stuff with the map, with maps. We might actually finally see transit data. Fingers crossed. although it's, you know, I am still on the Google Maps train. I love many, many things about Apple Maps, but its directions and traffic are still not my favorite. And it's not that they're bad. It's just that Google has the slight edge, I think, in traffic. I mean, they've been doing this longer. They have the head start. And I don't think that Apple necessarily still has the resources to catch up to them. So I'm hoping I'm wrong. I'm hoping we'll see some more maps improvements that will make me a happier person.
I love all these code names at Apple so much, but Proactive just sounds high fiber to me.
Yeah.
Not my favorite. I think the Rootless stuff is super interesting. The security stuff in general is super interesting, and it's this huge focus because it's apple.com/privacy, so it's right at the top. And I think the idea is that you can run. One of the big problems now is that people still run as administrator on Mac. There was this idea that Macs were infallible for a very long time, but there are exploits in browsers, there are forms of malware, there's phishing, there's social engineering, there's all sorts of ways you can attack an operating system.
The issue is really escalation, right? That you could escalate your privileges, the bad guy could,
So case in point, the UEFI vulnerability that was reported on this weekend is an escalation. Once they need to actually have something on your computer, they have to be able to have root access on your computer.
Right.
But once they do, they can take persistent control of that computer using a flaw in the way that it resumes from sleep. This is only for 2014, mid-2014 and previous Macs, but it's still a problem. And if you run as a standard user, it's not a problem, but most people don't run as a standard user. They run as an administrator. So the idea is the user shouldn't have to care. They shouldn't have to worry about who they're running at. They shouldn't have to go into settings and change their account and make all this. They should just not have access to the things that can do them problems, right, unless and until they decide to go and escalate those things.
This is the equivalent of hiding the library folder, right?
Yes.
So that happened last upgrade, or maybe even a couple more ago. You didn't see your library folder unless you knew enough to hold the option key. Will it be that simple of a speed bump, or is it going to be a lot harder to get administrative privileges or root?
I mean, there's there's the extreme example, which is on iOS, you have no file system access because they believe it's intrinsically not a human way of organizing things. But you've had technologies like this, like the Mac App Store stops you in large part going to websites and downloading things. And we've seen the horrible crapware that a lot of download websites attach to their download. So it prevents all that. Things like Gatekeeper will stop you from downloading apps, and you can choose Mac App Store only, trusted developers, or, you know, if you want to, anything and everything. But you have to opt out of that stuff. So I think it'll be similar to that. And sandboxing is another great example. And I think that's the same team who's working on this, is that it'll work. And most people will just never know that it's even there. And if you try to do something that requires a level of root access, you might have to authenticate or do something else.
But they already do that, don't they? I mean, even if I'm running as administrator, I will have to give my password to install a program, to modify system files or system folders. That already exists. This must be more than that.
Well, I think it seals off more because you can – the exploit here was just the fear was that someone could force you into a sleep cycle or something. So it can – sometimes it's not a major command. It's an otherwise innocuous command that something malicious piggybacks onto. And most people probably don't have to open up the terminal and don't have to access any of those.
See, functions. I do that all the time, though. I like to be able to do that, and I presume there'll be some mechanism for me to be able to have full access.
I don't know
hardware.
The details, but I assume, but I just from the name itself, it sounds like it's basically you run as administrator without root access.
Right.
Which is a huge boon. And there's a bunch of other security stuff that they've been working on for a while and ways to, you know, improve. If you want to just hand your phone to somebody, you don't want them to have access to everything.
Right.
And when I look at the state of security, it's so open right now. For example, and I've used this example before, my friend Phil Nickinson, he had a Motorola device that was a trusted Bluetooth object. And as long as he was wearing that, it could unlock his phone. But if he left it on the table, I could just pick it up and unlock his phone. It didn't know me from him. But now you have something like the Apple Watch, which you have to authenticate with, but then you have skin contact to. So it kind of knows that you're the one wearing it, and then you can start unlocking things. So you have these trust relationships with things like Touch ID and things like the Apple Watch that then you can start doing or using to extend your security, to project security the way we're projecting extensions onto other surfaces. And I think just the whole thing is security in general. If they could make it easier but also safer, the way Touch ID did, the way the skin contact sensors do, I think those are the big wins for just mainstream people everywhere.
As long as they don't make it impossible for people who like to use the command line. And I see, the reason I still use Macintosh is because I consider it a BSD system, and I want to be able to hit the command line and do stuff.
Unix Absolutely. POSIX, Leo.
And I don't think they'll ever take that away.
They better not.
It'll just be available for the power users who want it,
right,
rather than more overtly available for your average, you know, something, mother or father.
Something akin to holding the secret hold down the option key to get the library.
Well, you do that now, right? If you don't know any better, you try to launch an app that you don't know where it came from, and it'll say this came from the internet. You can't launch
That's a great thing.
But if you know, you can right click or you can press Alt and launch it.
Yeah, that's a great thing, and that's the right thing. Oh, you can hold on Alt key and do that? Oh, okay. Good to know. Yeah. We'll digress a little bit and get back to what's going to be new in iOS and OS X at WWDC. But briefly, since you mentioned it, let's talk about this UEFI exploit. Pedro Vilaca, who is a OS X security guy, says Macs shipped prior to mid-2014, so that's the vast majority of Macintoshes, are vulnerable to essentially an exploit that would own them.
Yeah.
This kind of a sneaky way to do it. You have to do it after sleep. The Mac wakes up from sleep, and then you can reflash the Mac's BIOS using the userland function to contain a rootkit or whatever the hell you want to put in there. And it does not, and this is really important, require physical access to the machine.
It requires root access, but not physical access. So if you don't have physical access, you have to use a different kind of exploit to gain remote access previously.
First do that, and then you can do this. So it is still not going to be something that's going to happen in a...
It's something the vast majority of people do not have to worry about. If you think you're a target, again, you can run in standard mode instead of in administrator mode. You can disable sleep.
So root pipe can't escalate you. For instance, that's one of the exploits. Can't escalate you if you're not running as administrator.
I believe this exploit can't take permanent ownage if you're not running as administrator.
So you need to be running. Okay. So finally, a reason. I always tell Windows users, do not run as an administrative user. But I've actually said Mac users, you have a pass because Apple requires you to authenticate even if you're running as administrative user to do anything dangerous. But this is now a reason why you don't want to run as administrator.
And it's these things. Apple has patched previous issues that are similar to this, and they're going to patch this one as. Of course, some people wonder why it takes so long, but you always have to check the code and then check the fix and make sure it doesn't create other problems. So you can't just rush out the patch and actually run quality assurance on the patch.
Well, that raises the question why they haven't fixed this a messages bug that allows people to crash messages, sometimes even crash your iPhone by sending a malformed Unicode message. People are all over doing this. I would hate to be a middle school iPhone user these days.
I spoke to them about it. They said they're doing it as fast as possible.
That's another one where it's probably, I'm going to guess it's a buffer overflow in the text rendering engine in messages because it even, as you point out in your article on iMore, even works in the lock screen.
So what it looks like is that there's a bug in the way that it, so these are Unicode strings, and it's happened before. It'll probably happen again because there's all sorts of weird things that can happen when you combine Unicode characters. There's Cyrillic, there's Arabic, there's all sorts of different character sets, and it tries to render them and it can't. And that failure causes a respring or a reboot, and that gets fixed. But who knows, for some reason, rendering Unicode is sufficiently challenging on a lot of these devices.
Yeah. So if they fix the buffer overflow, that's easy. But then, as you say, there could have side effects that you have to check to make sure it doesn't have side effects.
It looks like core text because it's not everywhere. It's not every app specific to messages, it's but it also text. Happens in the notification center.
Yeah.
And the recommendation is most people's friends got bored almost immediately after doing it. So
there's some risk because somebody did it in our chat room and his messages crashed as well. So there's some risk to yourself.
Yeah, so if it happens to you, just use Siri, because Siri is not affected by this, to respond to that message. And that will, at least on the screen that's initially displaying it, it's mostly the list of messages or the actual message and notifications that is the problem. That will put your reply first most in that stack.
And then you can delete the conversation and you'll never see it again.
Yeah, and John Siracusa had a really good point on this. He said it's happened often enough that it would probably be smart to put some sort of flag that says if you've crashed last, don't resume to the same state. Resume to a state that's to the last state, resume to a safe state. So maybe you can't go into that message thread again, but at least you'd be in an area where you could continue using the
app. But as Steve Gibson will point out, and he probably will next on Security Now, whenever you can get a system to crash, that's always a sign that there's a possibility of getting an exploit around it because, often what happens is it crashes, the stack pointer gets sent to a strange area of memory and crashes. If you could write to that area of memory some malicious code and get the stack pointer to jump there and execute it, then you've got an exploit. And so it's very often the case that a buffer overflow that leads to a crash is eventually weaponized to lead to a hack. So this has to be fixed quickly, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, they said they're going to be fixing it as fast as possible.
All right, let's pop that stack and recurse back to iOS and OS X improvements. They've said already that, or at least they've intimated that iOS... was it going to be 8.5 or 9? iOS 9
probably.
And OS 10, 10.11.
11. Question mark, if they're going to keep that.
They will be Snow Leopard-style upgrades. They'll fix, they'll improve, but not a lot of whole new... Well, there's some new features, obviously. That new root feature is a good one.
Internally, they're still 10.11 and iOS 9, but the marketing... They could decide that they're going to name them after Parisian streets from now on if they want to.
Right. No, I like California landmarks. Let's keep that, shall we?
The Mac, but the iOS doesn't have code names still.
Oh.
I mean, they have internal code names, like iOS 9 is Monarch, but they don't have, a marketing code name.
So they're not going to do an iOS 8.5. They're going to go to 8.4 and then go to 9?
8.4 will happen at WWDC most likely. If they need to, they might do 4.something to fix bugs and things. But iOS 9 will come out in September. So, and 8.4 is pretty high. They haven't gone very high on the point releases in recent years.
Okay. They always release a new one with a new iPhone.
So far, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That would make sense. There have been 9 iPhones, right? Something like that. 9 generations, not 9 iPhones. All right, what else? Let's see. So we've talked about operating systems. We've talked about HomeKit. We've talked about music. We've talked about Apple TV, perhaps a new subscription service.
I heard an interesting rumor that there's going to be a change in system font for iOS 9.
Oh, this new San Francisco font is going to be on the watch font, right?
It is the watch font.
You can open up the, which app, is it the activities app, Bren, on iPhone that shows it already?
I believe so, yes.
It's a nice font.
You know what? Yeah. It's a beautiful font. I love this font.
And it's designed for these screens, which is what we need to do.
Also because, I mean, I've been back on iOS for 2.5 weeks, and I'm surprised by how the thing that I miss the most is a clear, not whisper thin font on my phone screen. And so if they make it, normally I'd be like, okay, fine, you're changing the font. But now I'm like, oh, I would love to see what iOS 9 would look like with a different font, because maybe that will make me like this UI better.
Andy, you really have gone apostate on us. I am shocked.
I'm sorry, but I'm wearing Apple Watch. It tells me to move, but it doesn't tell me to sit straight. I'll try to sit.
Sit up a little straight. Well, yeah.
How's my apostate now?
Nice. Is this true?
Someone on Twitter. I gotta share. Someone on Twitter. I wish I could quote him. Said that if the Apple keynote goes past an hour, is there gonna be like 1,000 people standing up because they're watching?
Oh, at 10:50, we're all gonna jump to our feet. That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry that I can't credit him.
It's always at 10:50 or 50 minutes after the hour, right?
If you haven't moved already. Maybe you just get in your movement really quickly before the keynote starts if they're running late. The line then you're good.
It's going to be like a Catholic mass. Suddenly everybody stands up for no reason, says the
Jenny
one thing.
Fleck, stand up.
1,000 no's.
Will we see any watch stuff there? I mean, there's not much to say.
WatchKit. The thing that I'm looking forward to the most personally isn't the music, isn't anything else. It really is Apple turning over more cards about here is what third-party apps on the watches are going to look like. Here's what we're going to allow people to do. We've heard about Apple giving direct access to sensors to enable another generation of apps. But I'm looking at things like, are people going to be able to create like their own complications? Are people going to be able to create their own watch faces? Are they going to be able to create apps that are a little bit more muscular and not limited to just being a scrolling list of buttons or a scrolling list of things? Because it's the release of the watch is not yet complete, and I don't think that Apple Watch will be complete until we see a good, robust library of 4 real on-device watch apps. And Apple, of course, for now, they're using Handoff to simply have interactivity between a phone app and a watch app. But we're not seeing people design things that are intrinsically designed for a watch yet. So that's the stuff that I'm really, really interested in seeing.
If we all stand up at 10:50, I think we should make the Apple Watch salute when we do. Just saying.
That's the Wonder Woman version.
That's a bad idea because everybody has it on their left hands. That's a bad visual, Leo. Very bad visual.
No rotator cuff exercises.
Dvorak says this is the new fascist salute, is the Apple Watch salute.
Unless you put both of them on the arms of your little doggy.
Are you still wearing two? You're not wearing two, are you, Renee, really?
I never wore two. When I got the one that I ordered, I took off the one that with the review unit.
I canceled, by the way. I really wanted that black one, but I couldn't justify buying another
one. Oh, Leo.
So I canceled.
I'm both proud and disappointed.
I know.
So what you're saying is now you have $1,100 in the budget for a new Mac Pro.
Yeah, or a new 5K iMac. That's what I would probably get, yeah.
What's funny to me is I fell asleep with my Apple Watch on. I forgot to take it off, and I woke up, and it was at 47% still. And I think they drastically over-delivered.
I agree.
I know Jeff Williams said that they're going to be showing off native apps, but my concern level for what they can do with this thing, I think they have way more room to actually do it. It reminds me a bit of iOS 7, where they were so cautious
right.
about what they allowed access to for Blur right. because Blur was so hard in GPU, and then they just relaxed it over the next couple of months because it turned out to be fine. This might be the same thing, where they knew battery life was super important and they overshot it by so much that they'd be like, all right, cool, just go ahead, guys, don't be dumb, but you know, here's yeah. the wider range of stuff. You
went to bed yesterday at the end of a long day, did iOS today, so I showed the watch a lot. Used it a lot. 75% left.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Renee. You can see, especially in just the design of the watch faces, where it's okay. So every single watch face and every single piece of the user interface is black with a minimal piece of white on it, to as small as you can possibly make it, so that you're lighting up as few of these OLED pixels as you possibly can. I'm hoping that Apple at some point says, we're going to create in-house a really, really terrible watch face that's just nothing but like old-fashioned TV static and a cube and a Pixar teapot, a Siggraph teapot just bouncing
rotating.
Around. Let's see how long this lasts, and if we get 12 hours out of it, we will let people have fun watch faces.
Yeah. I would like to see an ambient display, an always-on display, as Android does, where because it really is disconcerting that the watch goes completely black so
for
easily.
Most apps, it'll leave the workout one on, it'll leave the Apple TV remote on. There's a couple that are exceptions, but it wants to make sure that you're doing something so active with your watch that it knows you're actually using it and don't just forget about
right.
it and
you know, right.
wonder where the battery life went.
Here's an interesting story. The new 15-inch MacBook supports 5K displays.
Yeah, dual link, sadly.
Well, not surprisingly, though, right? Because didn't we say the only reason you get a 5K display on the iMac is because of custom hardware, and it's right there on the board and all of that.
Custom timing controller that Apple
right. made. So, but the MacBook Pro will support, what does that mean, dual link? When, why is that a bad thing?
It's not bad. I mean, I guess it depends. I haven't tried it, so I can't personally render an opinion. I have used the old Duolink DVI cables, and basically one cable carries half the display and the other cable carries the other half. And the concern when you have that is that if it's not perfectly done, you see shearing down the middle. So you're moving it in one part of the screen.
I have that on my 4K on my Mac Pro.
And yeah, because some of the 4Ks.
Yeah.
Some of the 4Ks used to do that as well before the chipsets got to the point where they could drive, you know, even wide 4K easily. And that's the concern with this, is because it's going through separate cables, you're never 100% sure that they're going to be totally in sync.
John, what could we do with an old Mac Pro and a 4K display, just a 30-inch 4K display? Do we have somewhere to store it? We're going to put it on a shelf? He says at his house. So this is good news, though. If you got the new MacBook, that's pretty cool. You can get a nice 5K display running off of it, or since nobody sells does anybody sell 5K displays?
Dell has a 5K display, but I think the pricing isn't that much different than the iMac itself.
Yeah, you might as well just buy an iMac.
You really need two of them.
I'm more and more convinced that I'm going to have to replace my Mac Pro with an iMac. It's kind of sad.
But you dropped it from low orbit on your enemies, Leo.
Yeah, it's like a bullet.
Are there a lot of opinions on 5K versus 4K?
It's nice if you want to edit 4K video. It's nice to have your tools, because I tried it on mine. And in Final Cut Pro, if you put a 4K video there, you still have room for your palettes, which doesn't sound like much, but really makes a huge difference compared to a 4K display.
Well, and I'll tell you the other reason
I'm just thinking in terms of, if you have a 4K display, you have a standard display that you can basically use for the next at least 5 or 6 years. And that versus having one 4K display plus, let's say, a 1080 display next to it just for your palettes. So I'm trying to understand the advantage of having one 5K.
The other,
bigger, Andy. It's bigger.
They do want real estate, but the other advantage of 5K is the high DPI.
It's like 1K louder.
It's better.
No, Leo's right. It's a high
4K,
DPI.
4K, 4K, all the way up. Where do you go? Nowhere.
Because, you know, on my 4K, I run in high DPI, which turns it into a 1920 by 1080p display. Everything's big. But if you had 5K, it wouldn't be quite so big.
It looks like a regular iMac, but Retina when you're running at 5K, which is glorious.
So
I'm looking at you right now, Leo, in 5K, and you look glorious.
Actually, I bought the 5K for Lisa, so we have one at home, and I do like it. I've had enough time with it now that when she lets me use it. She also has a MacBook, the gold MacBook. She's really well-equipped. What else? Anything else before we move on? Thunderbolt 3 is going to start using the Type-C USB connector.
That's exciting.
Exactly. No, can you imagine that, like, of all the things we talked about today, the thing that gets all three of us saying the same thing, one universal connector, all we have to do is pack three cables and that's it.
Isn't that great? So,
now, if only there will be more than one port on all of our future laptops.
40 gigabits per second over a USB-C connector using Thunderbolt. That's fast enough to do dual 4K 60 hertz displays. That also gives you charging of up to 100 watts. It also gives you DisplayPort, USB, obviously, and PCI Express. So that is like all you need. That is nice. All they really had to do with the MacBook is put another one on the other side. If they had just done that, there'd be no complaint at all.
They didn't do it, Leo.
I don't know why they didn't do it. Maybe they can't do it. It's a lot of circuitry or something. It seems like
but it should be made clear that you won't just be able to get Thunderbolt. Like, that is a USB connector on the MacBook because it has USB 3.1. It's not a Thunderbolt connector.
This would be so a new it's the same form factor, but a new connector, really.
Yeah.
But the good news is that it can just do so many different jobs in one single port. So especially if you have a laptop that has mind-blowing the idea of having more than one USB-C connector on it. The idea of you have one cable, and if it's just a cheap $12 USB-C cable, it is a USB-C connector. You don't have to have something special. But if you have a need for a super high-speed data connection, you can get a super expensive, super sophisticated optical cable that plugs into the exact same port and simply does different things when it's plugged into there. I'm embarrassing myself. I'm so excited about the idea of just packing for a trip where I've got one sort of cable for the laptop, one sort of cable for the card reader, one sort of cable for the phone, one sort of it's like even last week at Google I/O, I was like, you mean I'll be able to connect my tablet to my phone and tell my tablet to please, with 100% battery, please charge the phone that only has 8% battery? Thank you, USB-C.
So to clarify, in all likelihood, you won't see this until the Skylake chipset from Intel. That's the successor to Broadwell, which is just now kind of, you know, slowly getting into the market. And it is a Thunderbolt. It is a Thunderbolt, not a USB chipset. So you'd have to have the updated chipset, the support from the CPU, from Skylake. It is a USB Type-C connector. It does give you USB 3. It does give you Thunderbolt. It gives you all the things that the current USB-C connector gives you. But it's Thunderbolt, not USB.
But that's one of the nice things about how it's tied to the chipset. All these manufacturers are going to start sort of giving away this for free because it would cost them money. It would almost be more expensive not to support this. It's the same reason why Apple had the only laptops that didn't have USB 3.0 until the time when suddenly all of them had it. It wasn't because they had a lot of debate over whether to support it or not. It was because they weren't using the chips that have USB 3.0 built into it.
So it's four times the throughput of Thunderbolt 1, twice the throughput of Thunderbolt 2. It is four times the throughput of USB 3.1, which is what you've got right now on your Type-C connector. Boy, this looks great. And because it's an industry standard, I think this is the first one where I feel like you really do have a shot at this one being universal. And you can carry a PC and a Mac and a Chromebook and everything, and same cables. This is great. Yeah. This is exciting. And imagine the docking capabilities, right?
Yeah, it would blow my mind if Apple decided to make USB-C connectors standard on iPhones. I don't know if that'll happen.
Google says it's going to.
Yeah. I mean, it would blow my mind if they did that.
It would be lovely if it did.
Ugh.
Yeah, exactly.
Ugh. Well, I'm so encouraged by the fact that they put it on the MacBook. I think it might even be possible. But it is the case that I think Google really pretty much said that's going to be the new connector for Android in a year, maybe. And that's going to drive us the market. And I have a feeling I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, if they put it on the MacBook, why wouldn't they?
Apple's not a spiteful company. The reasons why they have not used a micro.
Samsung.
That's different. Apple felt legitimately injured and they needed to correct what they thought was an injury. But I'm saying that they wouldn't keep Lightning because they feel as though we don't want to adopt this standard that is popular elsewhere. We want to retain something that's proprietary, and we want to sell a lot of these proprietary cables. The reasons why they went to Lightning is because it did things that micro USB did not do very well. Or you could see on a lot of Android devices that, hey, look, we have our own HDMI adapter that plugs in through the micro USB port, but it wasn't based on a standard. When you present Apple with a standard that they themselves had a hand in developing, that gives them all the connectivity that they want to have in both their phones and their tablets and their laptops, unless there are other reasons that are not publicly known, it becomes a thing of, would we like to physically design our hardware with these connectors, or are there still some physical limitations to USB-C that prevent us from making the sort of devices that we want to make? So they wouldn't do it simply just to be different. Because there was an actual good reason to do it.
This is how you put the lie to the idea that Apple does it because they're proprietary and they can license them, and they can do it because they make money, as opposed to
there's an upshot to this, but there's always an engine. There's almost at least I'm always been aware of an engineering reason why they did something and went their own direction.
And it's possible to imagine a world where the MacBook might have had a Lightning port at some point, and it was determined that the compatibility, the advantage of having a standard connector on there that did very similar, if not identical, things, far outweighed the advantages of Lightning, which there still are a few technical things that Lightning does that USB-C doesn't. That same equation would get run on an iPhone. It would say, what is the advantages we have, especially as we're moving, like they said, with the MacBook to a more wireless world, of having the ability to do all the dynamic things that we're doing with the Lightning connector and to transiting the kind of information data we want to transit. Do we still need to do that? And if we don't, what are the advantages of having a connector that's ubiquitous, that peripheral makers are going to do things for other devices with? And to Andy's point, it's a very simple formula sometimes. Do the pros pros outweigh the cons?
Mm. It's going to be fun imagining, even myself, if I had owned the new MacBook, I would be in a position where my phone takes micro USB, my tablet is a third generation iPad that takes the old style 30 pin docking connector, and my notebook needs the USB-C connector. So I'd be like, I can't wait for 2016 or 2017 because my life has gotten very complicated.
Too many cables.
Too many. It'll be nice. What a world we'll have. Skylike, Keith 512 in our chat room says, is probably July, August. So it's not so far off. So it's conceivable that, this time next year, we'll be talking about, Type-C connectors on a variety of Apple stuff.
Yeah. I'll believe Intel when they ship now. Yeah. It's my only.
Yeah. They said this, they overstated Broadwell as well, didn't they? As we're still waiting.
Well, I believe that Skylake is on time because Broadwell, the die shrink, was the hard part, and the architecture change will be faster. But the question is, are they willing to eat Broadwell to get Skylake to market when they said they would, or are they going to push Skylake out to try and make more money off?
Right. Anything else to talk about before we take a break and get your picks of the week? Mm. All right. Going. Our show today brought to you by Lynda.com, a great place. If, you know, I think human beings, I think if you were to describe us in two words, we are learning machines. I think it's a natural thing. People love to learn. Kids love to learn until it's beat out of them. Learning is exciting. It's fun learning something new, whatever age you are. It's more than that. It's valuable. And that's why we love Lynda. Lynda.com is for problem solvers, for the curious, for people who want to make things happen, whether it's developing an iOS app, mastering Excel, learning a new programming language, sharpening your HTML skills, or your business negotiation skills. Lynda.com has everything you need to feed that curious mind of yours. You know, we love photography. I'm a massive photo buff and always looking to polish up my skills. Lynda.com has just launched a new weekly series, The DIY Photographer. Joseph Lanashke teaches it. Take a look at the first installment. It teaches you how to make your own macro lens for a few bucks. That is the... Look at that. What is that? Cup? Paper cup? There's also new courses in exploring photography, exposure and dynamic range, creating panoramas with Lightroom. And, of course, many of us upgraded to the new Lightroom 6 and Lightroom CC. The essential training is always great. This is one of the things that I think Lynda does so well. They work deals with companies like Adobe to make sure that they have training the day the new software comes out, whether it's
you know, Photoshop or Final Cut. You can get the training you need right away. And that's really when you need it. When the new Lightroom came out, it was like, what? And it was so great to be able to go to lynda.com and quickly scan in the stuff I need. You know, those written transcriptions tell you a lot. You can jump to any part of the courses. There are over 3,000 up-to-date, on-demand video courses. You learn at your own pace. They're structured so you can watch them, you know, an hours at a time or minutes at a time. You know, little bite-sized pieces. So you can do it on a lunch break, coffee break for that matter. Browse each course transcript to follow along or to search for an answer, as I mentioned. You can download these and watch them on the go, including access to your iOS or Android device. Create playlists that you want to watch. Share it with your friends, kind of like Spotify. Lynda, LYNDA.com. Your membership gives you unlimited access to every video on the site. Whether you're looking to become an expert, passionate about a hobby, or you just want to learn something new, we all do. Expand your brain. Visit lynda.com/MacBreak, LYNDA.com/MacBreak for your free 10-day trial. 10 days, the run of the place. Lynda, LYNDA.com/MacBreak. We love them. And I'm really, I'm very proud of Lynda Wyman's success. She used to be on the Screensavers. We had her on many times talking about web design, things like that. She'd written the books on web design. Now she's what? She just sold, Lynda.com has been around for more than 10 years. She just sold it to LinkedIn for billions. Good for you, Lynda. You can come get me in your private jet anytime. I'll go, just let me know when you're coming. We just lost Andy. Oh, there he is. He's back.
Hi there.
Hey there.
What about your pick of the week, Mr. Andy Renacco?
One of the announcements from Google I.O. that reflects, a couple announcements from Google I.O. reflected are of interest to Apple people. One of them is Google Photos, but we don't have time for a 90-minute fight about trusting all your photos to Google.
I love Google. I just want to say love Google Photos.
I think it's great too. It's you need to have a discussion about whether you want to put all of your photos in the hands of a company that is an advertising company. I'm okay with it. Some people aren't. I just think that if you aren't comfortable with that, make sure you understand the reasons why you're not comfortable with it, and it's possible that you're turned around on that issue. But I respect people who just don't want
it's up to you.
I'll tell you, but maybe Photos is going to be.
It's
going to
hurt Apple because, frankly, it does. It's not only has the same name. Actually, I'm curious what we didn't talk about this. We should have.
Terrible search terms for anybody, though. If you're trying to find information on either of those apps, it's the
photos,
worst possible name.
Yeah.
It's pretty generic, but it does all the things. It seems to do most of the things Apple's Photos does, only better. Or am I wrong?
I wouldn't say that because you're not storing your photos in the original format, the original quality. It's marginally downgraded. We're talking about if you're using the free service. Also, the editing tools for Apple Photos are amazing. They're much more fine-grained and they're much more sophisticated.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed because Google has the capability. In fact, Google Plus had better editing tools than they've put in here. I think those are coming.
But it's a service, right? Exactly. This is I've been speaking to a lot of people at Google who work on this, and there are a lot of cool things that are coming about it. But the coolest thing about it, I basically had the stack of like SD cards from every photo I've shot over the past like 3 months. So I have like thousands of photos that I decided, okay, well, I won't trust my main library to it yet until I see what it does. But so now I've spent the weekend putting like 6,000 photos on it. And then the most fun thing is when it decides to do cool things, like it finds animations and it finds ways to do HDR and finds ways to organize things into albums, but also the depth of its machine learning for analyzing your photos and understanding what's in them. The first time I clicked into search, and I just said, "How about a woman in blue?" And
it's amazing.
Every photo in my collection of a woman wearing
Here's
a blue shirt,
Paris
or a blue dress
in the snow. I did.
Well, let me tell you the corker for me. I just said, "Okay, how about cosplay?" And it found hundreds and hundreds of
new
photos
cosplay
at Comic Cons. Not only that, but then I said I saw one photo in there, so I said, "Okay, clear the search." Halo. And it found the picture of two people dressed as Master Chief.
Oh, man.
It was, and so crazy.
I re-downloaded that photo to make sure that, did I tag that? Did I put something in there? And it's like, oh, my God, this is amazing. So it's worth, like I said, I respect people who don't have that level of trust with Google. For me, it comes down to two points. I don't, yes, they're an advertising company, but it's in their best interest not to sell your actual information to anybody. That they're just selling a position of ads to you. And secondly, if you are really, really upset about your personal information being trusted to a large company, you're kind of making an empty gesture, unless you are telling me that you run the Ghostery plugin on all your browsers.
There you go.
You're running your DNS and all your mobile devices is through an anonymizer, or you're running Tor browser, because frankly I personally feel that I'm under way bigger threat from ad trackers and beacons that are on every single web page than I am from Google. But again, that's a personal opinion, and I respect people. Trust is a hard thing to really explain. I don't use Instagram. I don't use Facebook because I get an icky feeling when I use Facebook. And so I respect people who have that same feeling about Google. But I do think that photos, they're really onto something, and it's going to get even better and better. And also, as there's so many good things about Apple Photos, one bad thing is how much they charge for storage.
Yeah.
And one of the great things about this service is the simple idea that, look, take every single photo you ever take and upload it to the service. It is always going to, excuse me, not it's always going to be free, but at least for now, for the foreseeable future, there will never be any charge to upload photos if we are allowed to downsample them to 16 megapixels and put a little bit more compression on them to make them a little bit more portable. But the difference between having to select which photos you want to upload to the cloud and simply saying that every photo I ever take always gets uploaded to this cloud and will always be available to me on every single device I have, whether it's an Apple device, whether it's an Android device, doesn't matter what it is, it will always be available to me, is a pretty solid feature.
Now, I downloaded the Macintosh downloader, and it's been uploading. I have almost 40,000 images. It's been uploading them. I'm going to have every picture, every digital photo I ever took is going to be here.
It's such a fun game, too, because it understands what's in the picture, and also particularly if you're taking pictures of, like, known landmarks. So, for instance, of course, I took hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pictures at the Yosemite conference that Serenity was at as well. And so it would automatically tag every single photo that was of a known landmark in there. So if it had Half Dome in it, if it had Yosemite Falls in it, it was automatically tagged. Stuff, however, that was maybe private, like sessions inside the lodge, inside the auditorium, those weren't automatically tagged. Right. But even then, it took a nice sequence of, like, at the after party, people behind the microphone, like, singing and dancing, and automatically made a looping GIF of, like, people dancing behind the microphone, like, oh, that's a lovely thing that I would never have bothered to create myself. Thank you, Google Photos.
I love the stories, which has always been a part of Google Plus, but now you can create your own stories using, the pictures that are on there. I mean, they're just...
Yeah. It's such a big feature. Do nothing. The service will automatically find albums for you. Will automatically organize, and it doesn't tag things, but it makes it very easy to locate things later. The last like gee whiz feature, and it was part of the demo, and it was so jaw dropping that I had to reach out to people I know who work in photos at Google to ask to clarify. Are you saying that Google Photos automatically In the collection of however many thousand photos had a picture of a newborn infant who looked to be about a day old and an 8-year-old girl, and it figured out that these are the same two people?
That's amazing.
That was, and yes, that's exactly how it happened. As a matter of fact, here is a screenshot from my own image library of, you can see, like, my son growing up over the past 6 or 7 years. I'm like, that is amazing.
Yeah.
And just the ability to show me pictures of this person, and this person is your son. And now you can just sort of start crying because it's, oh, look, he's growing older. And, oh, look at that tiny skin.
Try to remember those times in September.
And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon.
And you don't even have kids.
And the story is about how dad, like, won't come out and play with his son because he's too busy experimenting with Google Photos.
Yeah.
And, son, you automatically tag these things, but my little Indian dad.
You know, one of the blessings that came up with this is it went through my pictures of my son, Henry. And one of the pictures it came up with was a video I'd shot a long time ago of Henry at the age of 7 reading to me for the first time. And I'd forgotten I even had that video. And the fact that it came up with that was, if that's all it ever did.
We talk about really sophisticated features like matching faces and sophisticated features that are coming to iOS, but some of the biggest leverages come from the simplest things. Like, no, don't even bother trying to figure out if this is worth uploading or not. If there's a device you have that has pictures on it, if there's a CDR, if there's a compact flash card, anything, upload it. It will not cost you more money to add more files to this. And then it's exactly as you say, there are pictures that it unearthed for me, or it surfaced for me, that I forgot that I had. And so I'm not sure if I'm at the point yet where I'll take it. It's less a trust issue than an effort issue of going through the suitcase of hard drives and uploading everything to it. But it's when you think about how difficult it was when a friend of mine passed away, and someone was asking for it. You have old photos of your friend at these parties. Mm-hmm. It was like going through this suitcase, and because I knew that there was a really great picture I couldn't find yet, and I had to go search for it. If I had simply been uploading things as I go, it would be there automatically. Yeah. It's a pretty cool feature.
Google also churns the old photos, so. Stuff that was taken so long ago that I never made an auto awesome out of it or a collection out of it. It's going back through in time and making auto awesomes of pictures I took years ago, which is the computational power. Storage is one thing. I mean, the amount of storage they must be dedicating to this is one thing, but the computational power they're putting into this.
I can only imagine. I was a little bit disappointed because it only identified like maybe a dozen faces. And when I say identify faces, it doesn't know who these people are. It's
right.
Face matching. It's not face identification. Right. And so, like, gee, that's weird. And it was doing weird things like, here is, I had taken a picture in November on my Android Wear watch. There was a news story that involved a picture of Steve Jobs and Bono. And so that picture was on my round Android Wear watch. I thought that was funny. I took a picture of it. So it had broken that out. And so here's Steve Jobs as a recognized face amongst the 12 it had found. But
that's pretty funny.
Again, I'd taken at this conference in Yosemite, it's like I've got like 23 pictures in sequence just holding down the shutter button of Serenity talking. Like, you didn't decide that of these 23 beautiful pictures of like portrait, like you didn't break her out as a different person. But then it made me appreciate how much crunching of numbers it's doing, because it took a day or two for everything to really fully populate.
Right.
And it's kind of fun. It is like having a personal assistant who's you've tasked to the job of, here is every single photo that I have, and I need you to organize them into like logical albums and like do HDR on some of them. Because if you have notifications turned on for the app, you will occasionally get like a message on your watch saying, hey, I've just Google Photos has just created a new album, Yosemite 2015. Or he has a new album, Trip to Boston, April of 2013. I'm like, okay, thank you, Google Photos. I'm actually having dinner right now, but thank you. I'm glad you're working very hard for the money I'm not paying you.
It's funny. I've been just scanning through these. I was looking for this photo for months, and I just found it. Thank you, Google. Thank you again, Google Photo. So that's free. It is on iOS for the first time. It's been on Android for some time. It is partly Google Plus, but some of the features, the editing features in Google Plus, are gone for some reason. I don't know completely why. I'm sure they'll come back.
That's actually one of the advantages of this. They've essentially one of the bad moves that Google made a few years ago with Google Plus was essentially saying, okay, we've got a photo management service, but if you want to use that, you're going to have a Google Plus account. You're going to have to attach it to this. Whereas you don't have to. They've broken all of those old features out of Google Plus. They've added a whole bunch of brand new ones. So you don't have to have a Google Plus account. And also, there is such a deep and profound sense that you are not uploading your photos into a social media service and keeping them private. You are simply putting them in a shoebox that is not connected to anything.
Smart shoebox. Yeah.
Exactly. And if you choose to selectively posts, send some of these pictures to Twitter, to Facebook, to Google Plus, to whatever, you can do that. But as you're working with your collection, you are not in any way thinking, if I press the wrong button, I'm going to publish all of these to my Twitter feed or to my Flickr account. So I'm very, very happy with it so far. And as I say, because it's a service, and more than that, because it's a Google service, you can pretty much expect that in the coming months and the next year or so, there are going to be even more services, more features added to it. And you'll get more notifications saying that I've created a 3D immersive environment because you took enough pictures inside this birthday party that I was able to create an actual 3D map of the living room where you had the birthday cake. So if you want to put on your Oculus Rift goggles right now, you can walk around that room. I'm sure that's coming.
Look at this. This is several pictures of Alex Lindsay, and obviously, if you look at this picture, well, you know, that's easy to figure out. That's Alex Lindsay. But really, Google knew that was Alex Lindsay. I don't know how.
It's a little bit scary. Really.
In fairness, so did you, Leo.
Well, I did, but I'm a human. That's easy for me. It's a lot hard. And really, they thought this was Alex Lindsay? I'm impressed. I'm impressed, Google.
It was the other fun part is that, of course, I did a search for beard, and of course, there's 40 pictures of Jim Dalrymple. That's easy. Anybody can see.
Don't need Google for that.
That's really funny. Serenity, what is your pick of the week?
Well, let's see.
Do you have one? You don't have to have.
Turn
one.
On my pick of the week.
You named your lamp pick of the week?
I did.
That's funny.
While Andy was waxing poetic about Google Photos.
I love it.
I was really skeptical about the Casetta Wireless when I picked it up in store this morning because the box was a little crunchy, and I'm a little skeptical about home automation services that don't start with we and end with mo. But you know what? Yeah. I really like this so far. Setting it up with my router was easy. Setting it up with Siri is easy. And if it does in fact work with Nest, which it seems to imply that it might, I'm going to go out to Home Depot and actually buy one for the house today and test. If it works with Nest, then it is officially my awesome nice. HomeKit savior.
Nice.
So I'm pretty psyched about it. And it wasn't that expensive. I think it was like $220 for two plug-in light switches. So you can theoretically wire up two rooms of your house with just the starter kit.
Lutron's Caseta, C-A-S.
Caseta Wireless.
E-T-A. Hey, look, Andy, if I was looking for pictures of Andy and Akko, and Google made a nice little, here's a little animated GIF of you dancing.
Look at that little R2 in the background.
Renee Ritchie, you got something for us?
Absolutely. I have two things. One is for developers. It's called AppFigures. AppFigures has been a service that's been around for a long time, but they just launched their app. And typically I wouldn't make like a developer. It basically lets you track how well your apps are doing in the App Store. And I wouldn't typically make that a MacBreak pick. But what I liked about this is it's so delightful. I had a chance to try the beta and I wasn't expecting, like I knew it would be like a good crunchy developer app, but I wasn't expecting to be delighted by it. And it was a big surprise to me. And it reminded me of something Lorne Brichter of Tweety and Letterpress fame said, that when we transitioned to sort of this modern design, all the skeuomorphism went into the physics and the animation. And this was the same. I touched something and it bounced and it moved and it shrank and it expanded. And it was just momentary. It never got in the way of, it never made the app feel slow, but it made the app visually interesting to me in a way that didn't involve wood or green felt. And just that sort of thoughtfulness in an app that could otherwise come across as a database or a spreadsheet gave me a lot of hope for the field of apps in general, because I think for a while people weren't sure what to do, and sometimes very flat design became very monotonous design. And if you can take basically a spreadsheet of app results and delight me, I thought that was hugely impressive. So if you are a developer and you do track your apps in the App Store, absolutely check out App Figures. Go to the website, download the app. They have a demo mode, so if I don't have an app I could put in, so I just hit the demo mode and played around with it. And more apps like this, please.
I agree. Have you guys, are familiar with Wunderlist, yeah?
Yes.
And Wunderlist, which is, you know, it's ironic because I've used them all, AnyDo and Gina Trapani's todo.txt. I've gone through Remember the Milk.
They're gym memberships, Leo. Todo apps are the gym memberships of the App Store.
I have them all. But I finally settled on Wunderlist because it works on iOS. It works on Android. It even works on my Google Chrome. When I put a new tab in, Wunderlist puts my to-do list up on the blank page, which is very handy. Just remind, don't forget, which is great. Well, Microsoft bought them. I'm not sure that's a great thing, but it is probably a good time to download. They bought Acompli and they've turned it into Outlook for iOS, and it's great. Yeah.
They bought Sunrise.
They bought Sunrise, my favorite calendaring app.
Can you imagine Microsoft buying other people's app? Like this, just, like this whole world is topsy turvy.
It's a different place, isn't it? And in fact, it's funny because they had just added integration with Wunderlist into Sunrise. So I don't know if that's a coincidence or what, but my to-do list now ends up in my calendar very elegantly. Wunderlist will sync with Google, my Google tasks and other tasks. You make an account for free. There's paid accounts, but I haven't ever paid for it. And I just love it. You can delegate, you can do all sorts of things with it. Works with the Apple Watch as well. So, it's in the news, newsworthy, but, I have to say I've been using Wunderlist now for a while. It is from Six Wunderkinds, which is a Berlin developer group that was bought by Microsoft. I have to think you're probably supposed to pronounce it Wunderlist. But I'm going to call it Wunderlist.
It's amazing. It's like, again, like you, we're talking about photos by Google that works great on iOS. And we're talking about apps for Microsoft that work great on iOS. And it, again, to me, it's one of the huge advantages of the system is that because of its popularity, but also because of the kind of users it has, everybody wants to make apps for it. And you can, I'm like Andy, I would never upload anything to Facebook or Google Plus because by definition, they're social networks. And I prefer those things to be siloed. And I'm glad that, you know, Google's making a product that's siloed. I was joking around saying that I don't care about the privacy. It's the idea that they showed that Google driverless car thing and how the machine learning and the neural network, which is always a scary term when I saw it, when I hear it because of Terminator, but it can start recognizing all this stuff because of the machine learning, because of the vast amounts of data. I don't like the idea of Boston Dynamic robots tying into it maybe, but the idea that just all the, well, I saw Ex Machina last week and one of the, and without any spoilers, basically the guy manages to teach facial expressions by just putting massive amounts of data about human facial expression. That's what you need to get a machine to do anything. You need incredible amounts of data. And even if, you know, people say like your photos are safe, Google gets the ancillary benefits of incredible amounts of data and all their systems get better. The same way Siri gets better, the more voice data uses it. So it's beneficial to Google. They're giving this away for free, but they get huge machine learning benefits. And if they want to be the Star Trek computer, they're going to need massive and massive amounts of data. So they're learning all these faces. They can recognize Alex Lindsay from the angle, making a funny face with bug eyes because of all the data that they're crunching, and they're uniquely positioned to do that kind of thing. I understand if you object to that, you know, everything is a pro and con. Some people object to giving Apple money for RAM, and everyone can make those choices. But I think it's super interesting that we have access to all these options so we can pick exactly the one that has the best drawback to benefit ratio for us personally.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great strength. And it also points out that every single company, I think, sincerely talks about the good that they think they can do for the entire world. And that's not marketing. It's useful for marketing, but it is a sincerely held belief in all these companies that are transacting at such a high level. And so it's important to understand that, but it's also important to understand that almost no companies will articulate their vision of improving the world in a way that shoots themselves in the foot. So Google will give away this service in such a way that Google will support every single service phone that's out there because it's in their best interest to do so, to keep people playing Google as much as they can. In the same way that Apple values security and privacy, but because they have absolutely no financial interest, it's not part of their business plan. Part of their business plan is keeping you back to buy a new premium 40% margin device every year, every 2 years, which is so as iPhone users, you have the great advantage that everybody wants to make sure that their service is compatible with your device. But it also means that if you do decide to invest in a service that Apple runs, you ain't never getting those photos off of a device that has an Apple logo. So if you want to switch to a different kind of phone next year or a different kind of laptop next year, that's going to be a really big problem. So there's so much calculus to think about whenever you're thinking about making a long-term commitment to any piece of hardware, any piece of software, or any service.
I
just did a backup. So I have on my iMac, because I have ungodly amounts of storage, I just keep all the originals and that goes into the photos library, gets backed up to Time Machine, and I'll just point that at Google Photos when I want to try it and do a mass upload, because I figure Google's going to be smart enough to not care what the file names are.
Maybe not. Maybe they do. In fact, they might.
X973.jpg.
Exactly.
It's all Facebook metadata, service, baby.
If Facebook had this service, like I'd upload like just 100 photos, and the next day I get a little pop-up when I log in. Now, what is your relationship with P104471? We think you went to high school together and went to West Penobscot High School. Can you just confirm that you went to West Penobscot High School with P104418?
That would be funny. Actually, the folks at Bradley Horowitz, in charge of Google Plus, in an interview with Stephen Levy, gave an example of what they might do with photos. He said, right now, we don't share it, but not to say we might never do that. What if, for instance, we could determine from your pictures that you own a Tesla, Tesla were to issue a recall, wouldn't it be cool if you had a Google Now card that said, hey, you might want to check with Tesla, your car's being recalled.
Yeah. See, Steve Gibson says this really well, that it's not just the company now, but once you give it your data, right, it's the company 5 years from now, 10 right. years from now, 50 years ago, because that data is not coming back.
Right. They can have my data. There's nothing special about it.
Yeah, but that's a different issue. Like that's certainly a valuable issue for Radio Shack, where Radio Shack had promised that, well, look, yes, you're giving us your location information when you buy a pack of batteries, but we will hold your information in a vault until they go out of business. And now there's all these really valuable customer contacts that are now part of the assets of the company. And now AT&T and these, believe it or not, you have these wireless carriers that are in the unusual position of telling people you can't do this to screw over our customers, because only we get to screw over our customers. That's part of the we're getting into like a 2-hour discussion. I'm sorry, I'll cut this off quickly. But that's also another reason why I have less of a problem with Google than with other companies. That Google, if I wind up living in a world in which Google is out of business or is so desperate that they need to start, you know, melting down armchairs for base metal to sell at the scrapyard, I think I got a bigger problem than for society as a whole. Will I have to learn how to like shoot birds with a bow and arrow for food, because that's where it's not the
intentional stuff, it's the accidents, like when Google Buzz would give your location to everyone with Gmail. So like for me, it's not, I don't think Google will ever do anything wrong, but when you have access, and the same thing for Apple, I don't know about Apple in 2 or 5 years either, the more of my stuff they have, the greater the chance that I will be affected by any accident or dumb decision that they make.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why the second thing I did after uploading all this sort of stuff, there was no personal stuff in any of the photos from the memory cards, but of course I had it on my Android phone, and I had it on my iPad, and so there are pictures on there. And we're not talking about things that would embarrass me if they ever got out. But you know, you don't. If I need to make a record of a piece of correspondence, or if I'm just simply at a friend's house and my friend maybe did not want this photo to be anywhere in the cloud, so there were like maybe 40 pictures that I deleted out of the place for exactly the reason that you mentioned, because accidents can happen, and this is a brand Apple and Google's been in the photo business for a long time, but this is a brand new rollout of a service. So you're just waiting. It might be smart, as much as we're talking positively about Google Photos, it doesn't hurt to wait a month and make sure that there's no news release about how, you know, people are finding photos showing up in their camera roll that they didn't take. And they don't know where they came.
I thought that happened to me, actually, but it was, in fact, photos that I had downloaded by accident.
Most of my friends don't know that, you go to Instagram and you press the location button, and if you don't turn it off, that you can find their house. And that's, you know, for a lot of people, they don't want that. And once you point it out,
terrifying.
But they just don't know. They use it, and suddenly everyone knows where they live. And that kind of stuff concerns me.
I guess.
Yeah, that's when it becomes, you don't want to be able to do a search for names and get actual places back. There's so much. There's a reason. That's one of the reasons why I was so impressed with its ability to, again, in a private fashion, detect that, oh, well, you took these pictures at Yosemite National Park, because I have geolocation turned off. It is never embedded in my EXIF information, because it is too easy to accidentally post a photo that you don't know has been tagged with a location, and then suddenly it's not as though I've got ninjas waiting for that piece of information to come and hurt me, but I just don't want. There's information that you want to try to keep private, just simply as a general rule. So,
yeah, I don't really care. Anything they want, they can have. I, for one,
except
welcome
your car,
our new
car, because your keys are in the bag.
Yeah, I put my keys in a bag. That is true. My keys
Mr.
are
Tough
in a bag.
Guy, take your keys out of the bag and say that again.
Andy Anacco, Chicago Sun-Times, always a slice. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
We appreciate it. Always. We will see you Monday. It will be Andy Anacco, Mike Elgin, Georgia Dow, and me covering the keynote. That's 10 a.m. Pacific. We'll start a little bit before then, right after TNT. 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 1700 UTC, Monday for the big WWDC keynote. And then, of course, a week from today, we'll have lots of analysis on Mac Break Weekly. Renee Ritchie of iMore.com, he'll be in the keynote. So he'll give us the sense of the room.
I'll be watching it. I will not be in stage, but I will be watching.
You'll be in the room. My yeah. apologies. And of course, Sarandi Caldwell, who'll be in your briefcase, because she doesn't have an invite yet. But she'll get in there. I know Serenity is not going to let that go. Yeah.
And that, or I'll just sit outside the main hall looking very sad.
If you guys are still in town the next day, please come up. You're invited.
In your Eliza Doolittle costume with a bunch of posies.
I was told I'd be inside.
He's a governor. In
there. Or buy a flower. You'd probably be a good Eliza Doolittle. She's kind of got, she could be. I could see that. A little smudge of charcoal on your cheek there.
I've sung those songs before. I bet you have.
Are you guys going to be... in town the next day? We'll get you up here if you are.
Will be. I think I'm doing, there's a conference running simultaneously called Layers, which I might be in.
Oh, that sounds cool. All right.
I have to look at my schedule and whether or not my panels are Tuesday
no
or Wednesday.
Pressure.
But it's a, design conference. It's being run by Jesse Char and Elaine Strove. Nice. It's pretty cool.
No pressure. If you're here and you want to, we'd love to have you.
We're coordinating with Jason.
Yeah. Thank you, lady and gentlemen, for being here. Thank you all for watching. We do Mac Break Weekly every, yes, it's live. I reneged. I lost my nerve. I couldn't do it. So many people said, we want to see it live. All right. We want to chat room. Okay. So I apologize for giving you a scare.
You want
that
a
was
Mac
me.
Pro.
I was just being cranky. Yeah, anybody want a Mac Pro? Look under your seat. But so we will continue to be live, and we will continue to have a live chat room. I apologize for scaring you. Every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 1800 UTC. Please start your Tuesdays with us. If not, of course, you can get it on demand always after the fact. twit.tv/MBW or wherever you get your podcasts. The new website will be up by next week. I said that last week. The new website will be up by next week. We're scrambling. The hamsters are working overtime, but if it is, you will see, and I hope you will like it, and we'll talk about it and give you a little tour then. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll see you next time. Now back to work, because you know what? Break time? It's over.